from the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
I was just thinking, Andrew, guys, all I need to do is spill my cobalamin tonic like on the studio control, just like China Syndrome, right?
Sure.
And the whole thing would just boom.
Yep.
Yep.
It's called Zip. We're on the air.
Zip. We doesn't go on the air. Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone, and it's the Real World of Money. We're at December 27, 2017, and I have the distinct honor of having Mr. Goss sitting right next to me. Give me a hand here, kiddo.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to
day
you.
After
what are you
Merry
doing here
Christmas.
In the studio? Usually you're on the thing and you're in New Jersey and I don't see you and you look much younger in person.
We're in South Carolina at the other studio. But no, we made the trek westward to be here today. So thanks for having us, Patrick.
Oh, yeah. It's nice to have you here. I was over at your daughter's house on Christmas and got my baby germs, and man, it was great.
You got to get your dose of baby germs.
Get your baby germs.
Natural immunity.
I should explain that real quickly. In our family, we call baby germs are what you do when you get exposed to babies, like at your place, you know, you don't generally have them, and they're so cute and cuddly that you want to have them.
Sure.
So people would say, did you get your baby germs? Or are you going to have babies?
Yeah.
That's what we call baby germs.
Sure.
Yeah. But your granddaughter is...
She's
got these little curl things
going. Oh, man, she's the cutest.
What's her name?
Hayden. Yeah. Hayden, Kellen, and lovely Landon.
And Landon.
Landon Goss, a perfect little gentleman, I must say. His mommies are doing a great job raising him.
Well, you did a great job raising your mommies.
Well,
I mean, what can
half
I say?
Of them.
Half of them. Andrew Goss is a currency historian. He's a good friend of mine that we met many years ago, I guess in the early 90s when I first ran across him on a TV show. And he talked about money in a way that kind of, my head exploded, and we've been... friends ever since. He buys and sells gold coins for a living.
And American gold.
American. Thank you very much. Yeah. Not Swiss or anything
no.
like that. And his company is SDL. And he's a currency historian. And he studies this stuff for a living. That's what he does, studies. And he's writing another book, two books, Secret World of Money and Uncle Sam Cook's the book. And the third one called The Monetary History of the United States. How's that going?
It's going. Finished a movie in between. The Four Presidents, so that's in editing right now. Always something comes before the book. You know how that goes?
I know how it goes.
Preaching to the choir.
Yeah, I know how it goes. Mm-hmm. The Four Presidents, those would be the four presidents that were intimately involved with money and had a hard time because of it?
Yes, they were the four presidents who mysteriously found themselves at the wrong end of a bullet, shall we say. All died by the same method. Assassination by a lone nut. And the government went to great pains in each and every instance to prove the nuttiness of the killer, because that could be the only thing that would cause someone to kill a president. They had to be deranged somehow out of their minds.
Mm-hmm. They even, these presidents all monkeyed
with the money.
With what we talk about.
Yeah.
They monkeyed with the way the money comes into being.
Who issues it and how it's issued and how money comes into existence is the most valuable power. And I think it was Mayor Amschel Rothschilds from the very famous banking house in M. Rothschilds and Son who coined the phrase, allegedly, give me the power to coin a nation's money, and I care not who makes its laws. So the power to create money is the most coveted of all the powers. Maintaining the law, issuing laws, being the lawgiver is really irrelevant to the folks that issue money, because they know that with enough money, they can get whichever laws they need.
And this power to create money has somehow fallen into hands of the private banks.
That's correct.
Around the world.
That's correct. Yeah, in what we'll call international bankers, only because they want to do this for every nation on the globe. You know, the issuance of money in every nation on the globe is their ultimate goal. And in that way, you unify the globe. And I think the ultimate goal being a single issuing entity and a single currency that's good all over the world, that is the ultimate dream of the folks that have been engineering this entire affair for, goodness, well on 300 years now.
You've taught us about the New York Federal Reserve.
Yes.
That they are the bank of issue for this country.
Right.
And they are privately held.
Mm-hmm. That's why New York City has all the big, tallest buildings, incidentally.
So they came into being, I guess, in 1913, about 100 years ago. When were the other central banks around the same time, like, I don't know, in France or Italy and Japan? Do they have a long history?
Well, they do. You know, forgetting the Bank of Japan for a minute, the Bank of Italy, Bank of France, Bank of England, Bank of England, the granddaddy of them all, 1694. So the Rothschild family, of course, the Five Arrows group out of Curacao, these are the five sons of Mayor Rothschild, and he scattered them to the five main countries at the time, and Germany, France, England. Deny that they had anything to do with the United States or its formation, but I doubt that heavily. In fact, the rebels, that's what they were, you know, the rebels that were revolting against the crown here in the United States had a very hard time finding financing. George Washington complained of it in his journals, but somehow, just when they were ready to fold up their tents and go home, they found another stash of cash. And I speculate that it was, in fact, the same bankers that were fostering the entire idea of a revolution so that they could snatch away the power of the colonies from the crown in Great Britain.
But this famous family that people know, the Rothschilds, they then, you say, with your research over many years, they've been involved with being the bank of issue all over the world.
Oh, yes,
somehow.
Yeah, as these...
That's a big vision.
It is a big vision.
That's a big vision.
And we start small. And you just keep adding franchises, which is what they did.
It's like McDonald's.
Yes. And in many instances, it was the result of a war. Hmm. So like Federal Reserve Bank chartered in the United States in 1913, and 1914, you know, wasn't even a year, we're at war with the world. And in the conquests that come
and
from...
And where's the connection there?
Well,
I mean, talk to us like we're a golden retriever here.
Doodle. So, you know, the idea that you foster or encourage rebellion and war,
yeah,
and then finance both sides of that conflict puts you in a position that no matter which side wins, you win. And so this was the case. In the early days of the Rothschild family, Prince William, the Elector of Hesse-Cassel, which was a principality in what we'll loosely call the German states, he had as his banker a coin dealer named Nathan Rothschild.
It's always a coin
Mayor
dealer.
Rothschild, forgive me, his father. And he deployed the money for the elector. He was the one that rented the Hessian soldiers to the British to come and put down the rebellion in the colonies. So he was certainly making money there. And every time a Hessian soldier died in the conflict, he would receive a bounty, a payment, sort of like if you crash a rent-a-car. You know, you owe for the whole car. Otherwise, you just pay for the usage that you have. And this was really the war, the Revolutionary War, on which they profited on both sides. So by funding the rebels who were killing the Hessians, they found themselves in a perfect position to make enormous profits.
Were there any other big wars where the central bankers financed both sides?
That would be, let's see, every war.
Every war,
every war, yeah.
Yeah, you talked about Hitler and the...
Yeah, you go back to Napoleon. He talked about... in fact, I believe that the reason why Napoleon sold the Louisiana Purchase to Thomas Jefferson in 1803 was so that he didn't have to borrow money. And this was, of course, what gave us a large majority of the middle of the United States, the purchase, Louisiana Purchase, from Napoleon. Of course, just 11 years later, Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo, and of course, then they focused their attention on other parts of the globe, but France was definitely theirs.
And then you told us the Civil War. Both sides.
Both sides, right? Both, yeah. Sides. A very famous story told by Benjamin Disraeli at the marriage of the Rothschild daughter, Lenora. The head of the House of Rothschild made this famous quote. He said, "I shall divide the United States in half, half for you, Lionel, and half for you, James." And I suppose everyone chuckled except Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, who actually wrote down what he said. And this was in 1857. And curiously, in 1861, the Civil War, or the war between the states and the federal government, found the division exactly that way. Lionel financing the North and James financing the South. And curiously, they both had a pact with each other. They don't care which side wins. It's the very same thing with their presidential elections, at least since the middle of the last century. What they do is, again, finance both sides, and whichever side wins, they find themselves on top. So they finance both sides of the Civil War, they finance both sides of a presidential election. Hmm. Any battle.
Well, it helps when you have the ability to create money, monetize debt.
Yes.
Now, Ben Bernanke was famously asked one day, I remember the interview years ago, "Do you guys just create money?" And he said no, didn't he? Because
yes.
Then he added the idea that we monetize.
That's correct.
Tell folks what monetizing is.
Well, so you pick a debt instrument. If somebody, maybe you, listener, decide to buy a thing, and in order to buy that thing, you create a debt instrument, be it a mortgage, car loan, student loan. You say, okay, I owe you X amount of dollars, and you sign a piece of paper, a contract, which lays out the date that the thing is to be paid, the consideration in return, the two parties, and you have a contract. And so,
like a student loan, say, for example.
Or a car loan,
or
a house loan, or a
credit card.
Every kind of debt. So this debt instrument that you create with your signature and a meeting of the minds makes its way into the banking system, and the bank of issue for any country can take that loan, that debt instrument, and monetize it. So in other words, I'm agreeing to pay $100,000 over 30 years for this particular mortgage, and immediately the Federal Reserve Bank or the central bank of the country that this is occurring in can take this debt instrument into their possession and issue a corresponding amount of money. So if it's a $100,000 note, they can create $100,000 and put it into circulation to replace this mortgage. So the monetization of debt, as I pointed out in The Secret World of Money, is the ultimate power. It's like, that's the real power in any country, the power to monetize debt, because you decide whether the economy is robust and booming and there's plenty of money to do everything, or by your failure to monetize debt. There's a spurious quote that runs around by Thomas Jefferson: "If the American people ever allow the banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, they will deprive the people of all property." It's a spurious quote, but it proves a point. That when you're in charge of the reins, so to speak, somebody creates a $100,000 mortgage and you say, okay, I'm going to create $100,000 in money and put it and exchange it for that mortgage, put it into circulation, that causes robust economic activity. But if you withdraw that monetization of debt, then suddenly there's a contraction. There's not enough money in circulation, and we have hard times economically. So this ebb and flow of money is not a natural occurrence. It is, in fact, engineered. And so it's for that reason that the central bank really determines who gets into office and maintains that office. Now, you know, in theory, they're supposed to be hands-off, like in our country. The Federal Reserve banks would never admit to engaging in any kind of political activity. They're apolitical. In fact, their independence is what is stressed. They're not dependent upon the executive or legislative branches, and so they don't have to do anything other than the money business. But in reality, the owners of the Federal Reserve banks are the ones that engage in this sort of political activity that if we understood it to be, wait a minute, you mean the bank that's issuing our money is backing a particular candidate over another, they're subverting the will of the people. They would never admit to doing that.
So, when you, but then we also had then that, how many presidents of the New York Fed ended up as Treasury Secretary? Quite a few, right?
Yeah.
Geithner and...
I mean, there were a lot.
Hank Paulson.
Yeah, I think Paulson was one. These presidents
Bernanke.
Presidents of the New York Fed are generally elected by the directors of the Federal Reserve Bank. So the directors of the board pick their president, and that president sometimes goes on to higher rewards, sometimes not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone, if you'd like to be on the show this morning, we're live here in Dripping Springs, December 27th, 2017. We have lots of fun emails, and we're going to get to them all. We'll get to your phone calls, too, if you'd like to call in. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So the Federal Reserve Board is
Separate,
mm-hmm. And there, all they do is just
supervise,
and adjust interest rates.
That's
right. That's all they do,
yeah.
And that controls how much it costs for the banks to borrow money from the themselves, essentially. Essentially.
Yes. From their cartel.
Yeah. So President Obama, for example, in his 8 years, increased the debt from 10 to about 20 trillion.
Correct.
So where did that $10 trillion come from?
The Federal Reserve Bank of New York created it.
Good for them.
I know.
Good for them.
It's the ultimate job.
Nice
I'm
job.
I'm jealous.
So they created it.
Yes.
And monetized...
the debt of the United States. So in classical economics, we're taught that the government has a very fine line to walk because there's a fixed supply of money. Now, this is the gold standard idea. So the gold standard and the silver standard creates a fixed supply of money, or at least a closely regulated supply of money that's dependent upon the mining and minting of gold or silver coins. And in this way, government now can decide guns or butter, is the way most economics professors described it. So you can either spend your tax money on guns, or you can spend it on butter, on feeding your people. You can either go out and attack other people or defend yourself, or you can spend it for the betterment of your people. But in either case, the supply of money to you, the government, is fixed. And it's fixed by the amount of money that you can collect, in taxes. So if government taxes too heavily, then the economy comes to a grinding halt because there's no money left for businesses and individuals to borrow. So if the United States government is crowding out all of the private buyers or borrowers, then the price of money rises. And if, conversely, the government refrains from borrowing money, as it did in the days of Andrew Jackson, good morning, AJ, grandson, Andrew Jackson. So if they withhold this borrowing power and don't borrow a bunch of money, and in fact, if they create a surplus, now there's actually more money for the people to borrow, and that gives you a very robust economy. So that fixed supply of money has been a thorn in the side of the central banks ever since central banking was created.
So then that's why they ditched the idea that
of a gold standard.
Of a gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
And President Nixon took us off that. In, what, 71?
So. Well, I mean, technically. But in reality, Franklin Roosevelt took us off the gold standard when he closed the gold window. Prior to that, Nixon closed the gold window. Franklin Roosevelt simply made it illegal for Americans to own gold. Prior to that, the efficacy of using gold as money was a discipline that was put onto the American government through the Constitution. It's in Article 1 that no state should make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Look it up, by the way. This hasn't been repealed. It's not been amended. It wasn't an amendment. It was Article 1, like the first thing that they thought about, what a government should be able to do. And this power somehow wound up in the hands of private banks. And the backing, you know, when the Federal Reserve was established, they swore on a stack of holy Bibles that they wouldn't create more than one $20 bill for every $20 gold coin in circulation. So for them, it was a simple standard. Once you removed the standard, so that you said, okay, anytime anyone comes to your bank with one of your $20 bills, you have to give them $20 in real money. That was the only thing that kept discipline in the ranks. Because if you didn't have to turn over a $20 gold piece, why, then there would be no limit to how much money you could create. So necessarily, the banks were limited in the amount of money that they created by the mechanism of the Constitution, that only gold and silver were money. Everything else was a note for money, an IOU.
So the only reason prices for houses keeps going up for cars and other stuff like that is because there's more money out there.
Correct.
Chasing the same amount of, or chasing goods.
Correct.
Correct.
In the case of houses, it's the components of the house, the wood, the sheetrock, the electrical components, that sort of material, raw material, increases in price. The more money there is in circulation, the more the materials that go into the construction of that house cost, and so therefore the more the house costs. But there's another element, and that is the availability of cheap money. So if you think of money as another asset, another raw material that goes into the house, so yes, I need all this wood, I need all this sheetrock, I need all this material. However, I also need all the money to buy all that stuff. And if money goes on the material list, why then the cost of that money, especially over time, factors greatly into the price of the house. So if money is cheap and widely available, then there are plenty of buyers with the ability to borrow money, add it to the material list, and build that house. With a drought in money, when there's no money available, why then housing prices necessarily fall because one of the raw materials on the list becomes prohibitively priced.
So that's what happened during the Depression.
Correct.
The bankers cut off the supply of money.
Yes.
Right.
And this
they
ebb and
cut
flow.
It off.
That's right.
They
and the banks being ability being able to increase or decrease this money supply, or in the case of the campaign of Andrew Jackson, which he virtually proved that it was the favored borrowers of the bank that were allowed to borrow money while everyone else was cut off. So in this way, the central bank decides who is the ultimate power. Who? So, you know, the power to monetize debt, to buy this real estate and to buy these physical structures that people use, you think of the landlord class, if you will, where a person, a hard-working person, an individual goes to the bank and tries to borrow money, they say no. But a landlord comes to the bank and say, well, I want to buy that house so that I can rent it to this hard-working person. And the bank says yes. So the moneyed class, the propertied class, just kept accumulating more property, and the people were reduced to the renter class. And it was so bad that in 1934, after the Federal Reserve had caused the corporate bankruptcy of the United States, Congress created a federal mortgage program where there were standards set, and anyone who met those standards could monetize that debt and buy the house. So this availability of cheap mortgage money with fixed standards took away the favoritism that had been alleged up until that time. So now any American citizen, any citizen, in fact, American or not, had access to a central bank and the ability to borrow money. It wasn't as J.P. Morgan said during the Peugeot hearings, he said, it's the character of a man that I look at, not the collateral that they provide. Because he was asked to explain why he would loan money to his best friends to buy things, but not to an average person. Mm-hmm. And he said, it's not the credit or the collateral, it's the character.
Yeah. Yes. So how does the New York Fed, the Bank of Issue, utilize their franchise to their advantage that you would consider as unfair or out of balance? Mm.
Well, the member banks that own the Federal Reserve have unlimited access to capital, and they can bring to the discount window of the Fed. So you can't go to the discount window of the Fed.
I can't.
No. I can't. And no American company can. The only people that can are the members or the owners of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York or the other district banks.
And just to stop for a second, and I'll keep the train of thought, these owners are the usual suspects that
yes.
we know, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Chase,
Bank of America,
yep. Citigroup,
right. Hong
Kong, HSBC, right.
Wells Fargo,
New York Mellon.
Central Bank of China.
Yeah, the big boys. Okay,
yes.
So continue.
So these banks are allowed to go to the discount window and for varying degrees of liquidity. So in the case of a U.S. Treasury bond, they can borrow nearly 100% face value of a U.S. Treasury bond. I think it's 99 is the real number.
99.
So they can show up at the Treasury auction. The Treasury's auctioning off 30-year bonds, and there are 22 or maybe 21 now, I think one dropped out through merger, 21 primary market makers or dealers, primary dealers, that buy the bond. So U.S. government says, I want to sell this bond. One of these 21 guys buys it, and they buy it, incidentally, with the money that the depositors have in their accounts. Then they walk it over to the discount window of their organization, the Federal Reserve Bank. That's their entity, they own it, and they monetize it. So here, Federal Reserve Bank, here's the mortgage that Patrick gave me on this property down in Texas. So Federal Reserve Bank says, great, what is it, how much is it? We'll buy it, or we'll loan you money against it, one or the other. And they won't do that for an average person. They'll only do that for a member bank. So that power to monetize debt, allows them to loan the same money over and over and over again, and collect interest on it each time.
Oh. So this monetization of debt, would you say, is the reason why we have all of these bubbles out there today at the end of 2017? Here we are at the end of the year.
That's right.
We talked about it last year, the bubbles, and what are some of them? Student loan bubble. The
car loan bubble,
housing bubble,
stock market bubble,
pick your
asset.
Yeah, there are all these assets are in a bubble.
Correct.
First, define a bubble.
Well, that's an asset that's purchased strictly on the basis of its increasing value, and not for any necessity.
Of course, Bitcoin that would go right in there.
Cryptocurrencies in general.
Yeah. So these are bubbles, and the only reason they're going up is because they're
the only reason people are buying them.
Is it because they're going up?
Because they're going up.
Because they're going up.
Tulip mania being probably the most famous prior to the cryptocurrency bubble.
It was the biggest. Right?
Yeah. Tulip mania, where people were buying these essentially, I don't want to say useless, because tulips are pretty. But, you know, there's an asset that has no intrinsic value, no substance other than its prettiness. And people were paying enormous amounts of money, a literal fortune.
Back then, it was 1500, 1600, something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And people were just paying a fortune for
tulip bulbs.
Because?
Because they were going up.
That's crazy.
I know. They certainly weren't buying them because they were pretty.
Just because they were going up.
Yeah, yeah, they heard they were going up.
And so this monetization of debt with this newly creation of money, this gives the fuel
Yes.
To all of these bubbles.
To every bubble. Yeah.
So it's called you've taught us malinvestment.
That's right.
Yeah. Malinvestment, yeah. Which means
it's not really productive.
Stupid investment, right?
It's a stupid investment. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, no, that's been the way. And additionally, as the Federal Reserve quickly realized, we go all the way back to the Society for Useful Manufacture in 1794. This was Alexander Hamilton's creation, where he used the monetization of debt to corner the Industrial Revolution, if you will, in Paterson, New Jersey, of all places, right next door to my New Jersey operation. So he used this monetization of debt to create a manufacturing hub in Paterson, New Jersey, that created hard machinery, mechanical elements to replace manual labor.
Uh-huh. How does the monetization of debt and the bank of issue people, the central banks, play into the military-industrial complex? I mean,
once you decide that you want to build things that are going to blow up or create destruction, in this case, military hardware, the contractors that build the military hardware are anxious to sell it to an army. But the army doesn't necessarily have the funds unless the people decide we need an army. Without that, then you sort of need a conflict of some sort. So you could see the tie-in. It's almost an incestuous relationship. Going back to the Hessians and the Revolutionary War, all you needed if you were the banker in Hesse Castle, and they had all of these wonderful mercenaries that were ready to rent to another king who maybe didn't have his own army, all you needed was a conflict. And once you had a conflict, then that king had to borrow troops or borrow soldiers to fight.
Buy
guns, buy hardware. And so it was in the interest, if there was peace everywhere, it was in the interest of the central banks and the bankers to create a war so that your sovereign would need to rent troops and go to war. So any chance, any fomenting of disenchantment that you can do, you do. Because, again, if it causes conflict and money is required in order to build this military hardware and they can't tax it from the people in a lump sum, then they always turn to the creation or the monetization of the government's debt. And that's very profitable for the banks. So you should be able to detect how the war is profitable not only for the military-industrial complex, the manufacturers of armament, but also for the banks that finance the entire affair. And again, doesn't matter which side wins. As long as you're funding both sides, then you make sure the loser pays his debts. That's what reparations were all about.
But haven't there been really serious bad guys that needed to be taken down, or has it all been silly wars? I mean, one would, you know,
everybody wants to point to Hitler.
Yeah, I was just about to say, everybody says, well, you know, if we didn't get in, well, then Hitler would just be controlling the world and all of that.
There wouldn't have been a Hitler if he didn't have bankers. You know, the very banks that financed Hitler were, you know, Schroeder and Sons. It was Hitler's banker. I granted he had his own money, but the bulk of the wealth that the Third Reich borrowed for their armament came from the world monetary pool, which was accessed through the bankers. Without them, I mean, if they would have cut off his money, he couldn't have...
money, he wouldn't have bad guys.
Not bad guys that were powerful enough to do anything.
To do stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, so the mobilization of credit, the monetization of debt was one of the prime tools Hitler used. And, you know, if you look at the period, the resentment was built up because of the reparations that were put upon the German people after their loss in World War I. So the resentment meant that they were taking the bulk of their wealth and handing it over to the banks through the governments in order to pay for their loss, you know, their penalty for conducting a war. And they lost, so... Now, a certain portion of their economy must be surrendered each year to the victors. This, of course, was the prime reason why the German people backed Adolf Hitler, because after a while he started saying, hey, why are we, you know, taking a third of our industrial production and handing it over to these other people? Why are we surrendering our money to them because we lost a war 20 years ago? And in the case of Germany and Adolf Hitler, it was a classically trained central banker named Horace Greeley Hallmar Schacht. And Schacht showed Adolf Hitler how he could create a separate currency, an internal currency, to fund all sorts of public works projects, much the same as Franklin Roosevelt tore a page from Hitler's playbook in giving us the New Deal, you know, the Civilian Conservation Corps, CCC, and the WPA, Works Project Administration. It's where the government took money and engaged in huge projects that, in which they could employ armies of workers and relieve poverty. So this is exactly what Hitler did when he built the Autobahn and when he gave the people the Volkswagen, the people's car, you know, this sort of help from the government in fostering activity cannot be done without the monetization of debt. So if the banks aren't with you, you're out. I don't care how good of a bad guy you are. And in the case of Hitler, it was the reparations that fueled the German people's desire for a change. You know, it wasn't like the German people woke up one day and said, well, we're going to conquer the world. He channeled their negative energy into, you know, get behind me and I'll show you how to turn this all around. And the fact that he was able to create this internal currency and fund all of these wonderful improvements, that only endeared him to the German people. And I guess this is a thing people miss. You know, they assume he was some sort of a dictator who rose without the support of the people. You can't do that. You just can't. I mean, if the people are against you, you're done.
You're done. Andrew Goss and Patrick Timpone, special year-end look at 27, 2016, a little history in between, as you know. It's really fun stuff to see how we got to where we are. So here we are at the end of 2017, Andrew. And so let's take a big picture of where our listeners are in this whole thing. Where do they, how do they fit into central banks, banking, taxes, their salary and saving.
I mean,
it's just a big picture now.
Sure.
So they're sitting there and they say, wow, this is a curious, wow, this is interesting that we got to where we are. We're using this dollar and they create them. So if you're explaining to somebody that's just coming in from another planet, you know, how do you explain to them kind of simply of where they sit if they're going to just get involved and get a job and raise a family?
Well,
where are they in the whole picture?
I've spent 35 years attempting to boil that chemical potion down, you know, making people understand that being a saver, and if you're, I mean, that's what we were all raised to do, right? Save your money. And so if you measure the dollar, and we were always intended to measure it through the weight of gold or silver that it contained. And Congress was always free to say, okay, a dollar is 0.7734 ounces of silver, or a dollar is 1/20th of an ounce of gold. And so once you knew what a dollar was, much the same way as you know what a gallon is, a pound, or any other weight or measure, then you can conduct your affairs accordingly. So if you're saving dollars, and each dollar equals a 20th of an ounce of gold, then saving them makes sense, because each year, dollars are worth slightly more than they were the year before. And that has to do with more people, more population, more goods. In the case of a fiat or unbacked currency, what regulates the value of the currency is the supply and versus the demand. If the supply is very great and the demand is very small, then they're not worth that much. But if the supply is very small and the demand is very great, suddenly they skyrocket in value. So it is this regulation of the value of the dollar that working folks, regular folks, should be concerned with. So we started the year We measure the dollar now not by the amount of gold and silver that it contains, but by the U.S. dollar index, USDX. We started the year with the U.S. dollar index at 104, 103 high. We end the year now with the dollar index at,
Let me look here.
Are you looking at it? Okay. 93, I guess.
93.82.
Oh, let's call it 94.
Okay.
What the heck? Let's be generous. So you see that at the beginning of the year, your dollar was worth 104. And
I'm
I don't care what it was. 93.02, sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
That sounds better, 93.
Yeah, 93.
We started the year at 104. We end the year at 93. Now, if you put a paper dollar away at the beginning of the year, you bring it out now and compare it to the dollar that you might have just gotten last week, they look exactly the same. And the homogenization of money, you can't tell the difference between the dollar you earned last year and the dollar you earned this year. They look the same. But in pure technical terms, the dollar that you earned at the beginning of this year was worth more, nearly 10% more
10%.
Than the dollar that you're earning today.
Well,
so saving it all that time, if you saved the dollar at the beginning of the year and it was worth $1.04, and now it's only worth 93.
But won't that thing go back up to 100 sometime?
Maybe.
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 We don't know.
Well, but look, bring up a dollar index chart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for me, it's just a slow and steady march to the bottom. And especially as the other currencies of the world follow suit, because that's what they're measured against. They, instead of measuring them against that universal measure, gold, they measure them against each other. So sort of like measuring the distance from Earth of some, I used that analogy before, the parachuters jumping out of an airplane. They all look at each other. They're hurtling towards the ground, but to each other, their values or their heights remain relatively stable. Hey, I'm the same height as Patrick, but we're both plummeting to the ground at 200 miles an hour. So at some point, we're going to hit the bottom or we're going to pull a parachute.
But over all of this, as don't wages keep up with the rising prices because of the extra money out there? And then everything kind of stays equal, and you're just adding zeros, and who cares?
Oh, no. I mean,
it doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
And I'll tell you, it used to. So in the past, if you look at the Constitution, is that Congress shall have the power to control weights and measures, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to coin money and regulate the value thereof.
Mm-hmm.
So when Congress got together and they imagined the modern-day C-SPAN and Congress is arguing, we're going to devalue the dollar, we're going to make it cheaper, we're going to make it more expensive. Now, everyone knows that, or everyone should know that. Anyone who's paying attention knows that.
Mm-hmm.
But by keeping this knowledge hidden, we're either going to make the dollar weaker this year or we're going to make it stronger this year. By keeping that knowledge hidden from the people, then companies, people, everyone misprices their labor, their services, their products.
Enter into contracts.
Well, especially contracts.
Contracts, because you don't know.
How could you know?
No.
If you don't know what a dollar's going to be worth 10 years from now, how can you enter into a 10-year contract?
Well, that's why you've been a great fan of taking out a mortgage, because you believe the dollar will be worth less 20 years from now. You might as well pay them back with cheaper dollars.
That's right.
I mean, that's why you've said, you know,
debt is a blessing.
Debt is a blessing. Eat peanut butter and buy a home, because you're going to be paying back with cheap.
That's right.
Cheap,
with dollars that are worth substantially less than the ones you borrowed.
It's pretty much, we know that for sure.
Yeah, I think over a 30-year period, you know, you can look back over the last 30 years, for example, and you could see what's happened to the value of the dollar in 30 years. Now, those on the other side use the argument, oh, but you're paying so much in interest. You buy that $300,000 house, you end up paying $600,000 for it.
Which you do.
Which you do, yes, there's no doubt.
No doubt.
You do.
You can do the math.
But at the end of the term, what's the house worth? I always use that 1967 median point, right? 1967, you bought a house, it was, I don't know, $20,000 for a three-bedroom ranch.
Yeah.
And by 2007, that three-bedroom ranch, which presumably you paid for, but let's assume you didn't, that you just paid interest only for the entire period. And all the money that you paid the banks was interest. And that you still owed the entire $20,000 that you borrowed way back in 1967. I mean, again, that ties in also to why I don't believe you should repay your mortgage.
Right.
So you didn't. You didn't amortize it. You didn't make a penny in principal payments for 40 years. At the end of 40 years, you put the house on the market, it's worth $250,000. Does it really matter that you didn't pay the $20,000? Not much. Doesn't. So it is almost a guaranteed circumstance, even when you pay interest, that especially at artificially low interest rates. See, this was the other factor that led me into that, which is that the central bank artificially manipulates interest rates and then allows you to lock in those low interest rates. So how does the average American take advantage of this phenomenon? And the answer is by monetizing debt.
By taking out a mortgage.
Yeah, if clearly interest rates are at the low end of the scale, 4%, 4.5%, and you can borrow money at 4.5%, when in reality, if it weren't for the manipulation of the central bank, the price of money, the cost of money, would be significantly higher than it is. So when you're allowed to monetize this debt at the lower artificial levels, that benefit inures to you for 30 years. So
yeah, but that's why you do a fixed and not one of these things.
Not a variable.
Not a variable rate. You know, then.
This is my last choice, a variable rate mortgage. However, if it's the difference between buying something and not buying something, take a variable rate until you can get a fixed. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone, special edition, year end. Andrew's in the studio here in Dripping Springs visiting family. Mm. It is oneradionetwork.com. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So folks get bombarded by the news, and they always talking about the president and politics and what the president's saying, what the president's doing. And overall, how important is it what somebody like President Trump is doing?
President doesn't have much power.
I guess, I don't know.
He doesn't have the power that
But that tax thing was big, right?
That was big.
That's a big thing that's going to affect a lot of people.
And I've heard so many people characterize this as a tax cut for the wealthy.
Well, yeah, because that's on the media, right?
Yeah. And it is what the media, the president calls it fake news.
Yeah.
And it's not, I don't think it's as much fake news as it is the news that they choose to tell you. Doesn't mean it's fake. It's
selective. Just means, kind of.
Yeah, selective, more than anything else. So we're not going to focus on this, but we're going to focus on that.
Right.
It doesn't make that any more true than this, right? Mm-hmm. It just means we're not going to look at this. We're going to focus on that. And so by determining what becomes the subject of news, then the news media has a power that just, it's almost unparalleled.
Sure. So, but President Trump's idea, I guess, is fair to say that he uses debt as a blessing, and so he wants to get tax cuts, corporate rates down, so get things kind of rolling, get the GDP up, and everybody's happier, and they'll vote for him again in four years. And
so the job of the central bank is to control inflation, and to the extent that government helps them control inflation, when they are the cause of inflation, right? So take the current central bank regime. And the prior regime of President Obama, and he was my president, by the way. I didn't vote for him, and I didn't like his policies, but boy, he was my president, and I respected his office. That's something that seems to be lacking this time.
You think?
I've not seen anything like it. So at any rate, that president decided that in order to control inflation, and he probably did this in consultation with his economic advisors, that he needed for the unemployment rate to be kept relatively high, and that he needed for taxes on corporations to be kept relatively high, and taxes on people to be kept relatively high. And this way, he could control the descent of the dollar, or the value of the dollar. He could actually give it strength by taking away the purchasing power of citizens and of corporations, and also the productive power. So when the borders are porous and wide open, and people can just stroll in and get a job, then they can mitigate wage increases, which would be a natural occurrence with sealed borders. The same thing. You only have a certain quantity of people, and these people are going to ask for more money to conduct their labor or to sell their goods. So this president, the prior president, President Obama, chose to regulate this on the demand side. So by mitigating or dampening demand for higher wages or demand for manufacturing, he kept inflation in check. And these artificial governors that are placed on the economy in order to regulate inflation, that's what regulation is all about. Maynard Keynes talked about it, John Maynard Keynes, where if the government were to refrain from regulation, then the worthlessness of money would soon be revealed. So by taking away your portion of a portion of your wages and a portion of your profits, and by making you have to compete with folks that have an uneven advantage, they force down your wages, they force down your value. And that was the technique of that president. Then this president comes along and says, wait a minute, I see what's wrong with this economy. Huh. We have all these artificial governors regulating and preventing economic growth. So I'm going to remove the governors. And the people that he refuses to listen to, the economists, would be screaming at him. But if you do, you're going to lessen the value of the dollar. If you refrain from regulation, then the worthlessness of money will soon be revealed. I've often asked, if in fact money has no substance, if in fact you can simply create it at will, why does the government need our money at all? Why doesn't it simply create all the money that it needs to conduct its affairs? And it is that inflation answer. That's why they don't do it. So
yeah, that's back to your original argument. Right. About, I mean, why borrow money why when
borrow
you can
money
just create it?
Just create it.
Yeah.
This president decided, well, we would be better off as a nation if I remove the governors, the restrictors that are keeping our economy in check, without regard to the inflation it may or may not cause. I don't know how much of a mistake that'll turn out to be, but I do know that while it's happening, it'll feel good. And I know McChesney Martin, a previous chairman of the Fed, famously said that the Fed's job is to take the punch bowl away from the party just when it's getting fun. And in this case, we haven't had a punch bowl for so long that, you know, this president's out there spiking the punch, and it's going to feel really good. You know, we're all going to be just zooming and booming in terms of wages and money to spend and so forth. This idea, again, I guess where we started, that this is a tax cut for the wealthy. I don't know if maybe they're reading a different bill from the one that I'm reading, but as I understand it here, state and local taxes are limited to $10,000. A deduction
that you can write off.
That you can deduct.
Right.
Now, I know most people I know pay less than $10,000 in property taxes. And here in the state of Texas, there's no income tax, right?
Right.
No local tax. Mm-hmm. It's just property tax. So if your property taxes are less than $10,000 and your individual deduction doubled, went from $12,000 to $24,000, you're seeing an enormous tax cut. But let's say
regardless of whatever your adjusted gross income is.
Correct. Okay. And forget the tax rate.
Okay.
You know, I get that they cut the tax rate on the ultra wealthy from what,
39 to 37.
Right. Yeah. A tiny tax cut when you offset it against. So I'm looking at one of those New York penthouses in the Pencil Building in Manhattan. $70 million for this penthouse. $70 million, Patrick. What do you think the property taxes a year on that place is?
Oh, I don't
know. $10,000.
No.
And who do you think's living there? The rich and the ultra rich. And no matter what they're reporting as income, only $10,000 of it is deductible to them, both in state and local taxes.
Last year, was there a cap at all?
No.
Whoa.
So if they were paying
there was no cap.
$7 million a year
they would write
in
that
interest,
off.
They could write the entire thing off.
Well, the rich guys could not be happy with Donald right
now. No. Hey, this is a tax. the tax increase on these wealthy folks has got to be the biggest one in history when you stop looking at the marginal rate and look at what they're no longer allowed to deduct. Hmm. And as a general rule, and I do know some rich folks, I will call them very wealthy, and $10,000 to them is a joke. I mean, houses around Franklin Lakes, New Jersey, $4 and $5 million houses, are yielding $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year in property taxes. And those rich folks,
they're not going to be able to write that off
anymore. $10,000.
Yeah, $10,000, which is huge.
What a tax increase for those people. Yeah. Because now you've just increased the amount of money that they have to pay taxes on. So imagine the wealthy guy before who's paying himself $10 million a year, but he's paying $7 million in interest on loans for properties that he owns that are gaining value each year, and taxes, property taxes on all of that, which now suddenly is no longer deductible. So that means now his adjusted gross income isn't cut by 70% or 80% as it was last year, mm-hmm. where he could deduct all of his interest, all of his property taxes. Now he's limited in both to what most of America, American property owners, most of us,
pay $10,000. It would be great to hear President Obama just say what you just said and to let people know.
President Trump?
I mean, President Trump.
I'd love to hear President Obama.
I would hear President Obama say that.
But, you know, neither will.
Yeah.
I don't know. I will say that, you know, this president uses his own bypass the media method, right? What most
Twitter
people
thing, yeah.
Twitter. He tweets. And it's whether or not the media chooses to report it. What I'm getting at is, even if the president decides, I'm going to hold a press conference in the White House tomorrow, and I'm going to tell America what Andy just said, that the very rich people
are really getting hammered.
Hammered with this tax. Nobody's going to report that.
Report it, yeah.
So, you know, by going around the media and taking his message right to the people, mm-hmm. hopefully we'll get it. But I.
Which is the reason, I guess, that he's so criticized for the tweets.
Yes.
They
oh,
keep
we
trying
can't
to
have
the, to
No, we it. Want to filter yeah. what you're saying and yeah. tell the American people what you meant. We don't want them to just hear you say it. Yeah.
And this tax thing is going to be around for a long time. This is the last time they had this big of a deal.
Tefra.
Was, what, 1980?
No, I know. No? I would say that this is incomparable to any.
Really?
Any ever. Ever. Because what it did this time, the revenue increase to the federal government is going to be enormous. Either that or the rich people, the very wealthy among us, are going to, they have to move. I mean, there's really no other way for them to avoid the tax. In the past, they could simply buy a bigger house, buy another property.
So this tax cut is going to bring more revenue in?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Mountains of revenue.
Because there'll be more corporations, even though they're paying less, there's going to be more business, more guys will open more taco stands, whatever they do, stuff like that.
We are a booming nation. Believe this or not, right? When I said it last year, earlier in the year, there's 1,600 new millionaires created every day.
Is that right?
In the United States, 1,600. Mm. So, you know, millionaire is not a billionaire, but the volume of taxes paid by the ultra rich and the volume of their deductions. So you look at an ultra-rich guy's tax return, and those first two deductions, interest and local and state taxes, they're probably the number one shield or shelter from taxes.
So, and plus, you've taught us that the amount of corporate tax that comes in is very a small percentage compared to...
That's right.
Right. It's what, 20% or something like
that? It's the individual income tax.
That's where all the money...
And the payroll tax is where the money comes in. Mm-hmm. So I think when I tracked it this year, I think we were in September, when we were talking about it. It wasn't yet a plan. We were talking about the idea of a tax cut. It was corporations, I think, where at the time had paid in... $200 billion.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah, I think it was around in there.
I think it was
around
$200 billion, where individuals had already paid in $1.4 trillion in individual income tax and payroll tax. So when we raise corporate tax rates very high and we drive our corporations offshore, like, why would you stay in the United States and pay 39% when you can do your business in Ireland and mail your goods to the United States and pay 12%.
Yeah.
There's no reason. So corporations were packing up their shops and moving because we have no tariffs, and that's the...
And the president ran on this.
Sure he did.
Yeah, yeah.
This is why I supported him
yeah.
day one.
Yeah.
And, okay, would I have loved to have a better messenger? You bet. Yeah. The guy is a flawed messenger. But no, I won't argue with anyone
sure.
on that point.
Sure.
But the message is what's important to me. And what was wrong with this nation's economy was so simple to fix. You know, if it could have been a better messenger, I would have preferred it as long as he had the same message, which was the idea that the working people of this country should pay for the operation of this country. So all of the profits to the foreign corporations, Mitsubishi and name your foreign corporation that sells their goods in the U.S., takes all of their profit home to their home country and pays taxes over there. That's why China has a $5 trillion infrastructure program. That's why South Korea has the best infrastructure for the internet in the world. And our infrastructure, you know, 40 years old and 20% of
falling
it subservient.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that reason, because there's not enough revenue to our government, because we've diverted our tax revenue to other nations. If we had a strong protective tariff, and John McCain, I think, revealed himself when he accused President Trump of being a nationalist. Like, that's the worst thing you can be.
Yeah.
A guy who thinks, oh, this nation is superior to every other and Americans are superior to everyone else. Oh, you might as well be a racist because, you know, that's what you're exhibiting, the idea that you're going to favor America and favor American workers over anyone else in the world. Why, that's not a very globalist notion at all, is it?
Andrew Goss and Patrick Timpone, it is the Real World of Money special edition. Last week in December 2017, we're going to talk about a lot of things, what NDC is going to be coming up next year, and these bubbles, and we have lots of fun emails. So let's just do this quick little break, and then we'll be back.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Okay, this is the Real World of Money. Andrew Goss is sitting next to me in the studio here at Dripping Springs on our very spacious, luscious Dripping Springs studio. We have a great view out here, don't
sure
we, Andrew?
Sure do, man.
Isn't it cool?
The hill country. Yeah,
just
beautiful.
Look outside.
Love
here.
It, love it.
If you'd like to be on the show, 888-663-6386, email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. We went through a little history now. So what do you think are some of the more curious things on the horizon for 2018 that we, the people that like to look at these things called finances, what do you see out there as possible landmines, black swans,
Well, landmines.
Dumb things that can happen.
The landmine is this two-week continuing resolution.
But,
thing.
You know, you keep saying that, Andrew, but
they always keep rolling it over every two weeks.
You know they're going to do that.
Yeah, until they don't. Until, you know, they're so emboldened with the idea that we're going to use this as leverage. And we're going to hold something hostage.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that's not good. It's just not a good way to run a government, let alone an economy. But yeah, that to me, this is probably the biggest threat. And then, of course, all of these bubbles. It's like, hold your ears, because I'm cringing at, there's so many. The stock market bubble, the bond market bubble, I think more than any other, as I've said before. So I'm very concerned that one of these... bubbles popping could just put so much pressure on the markets.
And what would make what would precipitate a pop like in the bond bubble? If I understand it, is because
raising rates,
the interest rates have been so low,
right?
And then if they raise rates, then people start selling.
Correct? Yeah,
the people start selling.
Right,
right.
I mean, the people that bought the bonds didn't buy them to hold them for 30 years. They bought them because as interest rates fall, principal value rises. And as interest rates rise, principal values fall. So folks that are owning bonds or holding bonds, Fed raised interest rates a quarter point after the last meeting. If they're on track and do this at every meeting, quarter point. Pretty soon, individual bondholders, bond funds, and institutions will start selling their bonds and refrain from buying others, because why would you buy it today at 4% when you can wait next year, it'll be 5 or 6 or 7 and so on. So that's probably the biggest threat right there, is the bond bubble. And I fully expected it to pop before now, to be quite frank.
And then you have told us, Andrew, that the stock market, one of the reasons it keeps going up is because of this cheap money,
yes,
that the banks have to,
right,
they can borrow money and then they buy their own stock. And,
correct.
And the big heavy players are in there buying, yeah, with borrowed money.
Buying their own stock.
Buying their own
with
stock.
With borrowed money.
Okay.
And then pledging that same stock to borrow more money to buy more stock.
And then why, what would precipitate that ending, that practice?
Again, the cost of money.
The cost of money.
Yeah. When it becomes unprofitable to do that.
So what if the Fed, the new Fed guy that President Trump just appointed, what if he just keeps these things low?
Then or puts the brakes on?
Ooh. What do you mean? Keeps the interest rates low. So
And puts the brakes on any increases.
Right.
And says, I'm just going to keep rates at where they are or lower.
Then what happens then?
The economy will explode.
Really?
Yeah. Well, inflation will rage like it did from 77 to 80.
How do you mean when Jimmy Carter was in his sweater and stuff,
yes,
like that? Yes,
whip inflation now.
And all,
yes,
that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be very bullish for gold, very...
bullish for every kind of property.
And anything like that.
Any things. And the collecting mentality is really taken hold. We talked about last month, or maybe the month before, the 400... I still can't wrap my head around this. $500 million for a Da Vinci painting. $500 million with a B. $450 million.
It was a cute painting.
Yeah, it was cute. But so those types of fixed supply assets will increase.
So is it possible, is it a possibility that President Trump, as good as business guy as he is, could end up with a tiger by its tail?
Yeah, I think so.
He could.
Yeah.
And then you know, it would rage.
So what has made most Americans wealthy over the last two generations, and I'm talking about rank and file Americans, right?
Mom and pop.
Has been the purchase of their house,
mm-hmm,
right? Their
mm-hmm
home.
Mm-hmm.
They purchased it at the end of 30 years. They've
worth a lot
paid
of
it off, and it's worth a lot of money. They sell it, and they use that money to fund their retirement.
Right.
That's been anemic for the last decade, since 2007.
Anemic. I thought home
growth.
Prices were going up
just,
all the time.
Just starting.
No.
No, for
really?
We took such a punch in 2008.
That, yeah, yeah.
6 years, I think, for 6 years, that growth was just absent.
Yeah. Speaking of 2008, are you predicting, I know you don't predict, but you suspect that there could be an event in the next couple of years, either next year, that would be equal or worse than this Great Recession?
Well, dollar-denominated debt has more than doubled since 2008 worldwide. We've more than doubled the amount of debt in that
just
period.
Everything, corporate, private, everything.
That's right.
Yeah.
So as I've measured or talked about the measure of money in the past, and, you know, this show's been on for 10 years now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so
right here, yeah.
M1, M2, M3, and L were the traditional monetary measurements. M1 being all cash in circulation, and M2, you throw in the CDs and so forth. M3, now you include the bonds, long-term bonds, and corporate debt, and so on. And L is all the money in circulation. So I've added a new measure, P, potential money.
Mm-hmm.
So what else could the Federal Reserve turn into money? Could they monetize all of the student loans? Sure. Could they monetize all of the corporate debt? Sure. Could they monetize the debt of foreign nations? Sure. Central Bank, I'm trying to think of which one. I think it's the ECB, found itself the owner of junk bonds because the bonds that they bought during the rage were downgraded by the credit rating agencies. And so now the European Central Bank actually owns junk bonds.
Yeah, didn't we talk about it sometime during the year, Andrew, of 17, where Mario Draghi, also former Goldman Sachs.
And a central banker.
And a central banker of the ECB was running out of things to monetize.
That's correct.
He was running out of things to buy.
That's right.
He said, I've got my magic computer here.
And it tells me.
And I just want to do more.
Yeah, but I there isn't anything to do.
There ain't anything to do.
And the Japanese fell upon the similar problem. Yeah. And what they did was started buying real estate. Yeah. They started buying bonds of private corporations.
They would create yen
and buy Yeah, everything. Stocks. They were buying real estate investment trusts. So the central banks have traditionally withheld from these markets. If you look at our central bank, the Federal Reserve, 2008 was the first time that they ever bought anything or monetized anything that wasn't sovereign debt. Debt issued by the government of the United States.
In 2008?
That was the very first time.
I thought that went out the window with the Monetary Decontrol Act in 81, being able to monetize stuff.
Their ability was there.
But they didn't do a lot of it.
They never did it.
What did they do in 2008, you taught us, they did mortgage-backed securities.
First time.
Credit default swaps.
First time.
First time.
First time.
So just derivatives.
Yeah. The idea that they would buy these synthetic securities and create the money to do it, that was just unheard of 20, 30 years before. It's a relatively new phenomenon that central banks would monetize something other than the sovereign debt of the government.
And you think about it, every time I watch that movie, Too Big to Fail, which is a great movie, or The Big Short is actually a better one, where these banks were actually creating a synthetic instrument called mortgage-backed security or a credit default swap, just a bet. Is it just no more than a bet, right?
Somebody came up and said, "Hey, I want to bet.
I'm going to bet that I want to bet that this is going to go down. What do you? How much will this cost?"
Right.
And they got in all head over feet over the whole thing because of whatever, right? Then the government just bought them all.
That's right.
The government just bought them all. Well, not the government. I mean,
the equivalent of that hazard would be. Let's say you have a $100,000 house and you call up your insurance agent and say, I want to buy $500,000 worth of insurance on my house.
Yeah.
The insurance agent says, no, you can only insure it for what it's worth.
Yeah.
Well, that would be the end. You wouldn't create any incentive for you to do anything untoward. But if the insurance agent said, oh, sure, go ahead and buy as much insurance as you want. So I have a $100,000 house. I want to insure it for $10 million.
I'll do it.
And then I'm going to go burn it down. Now I have an incentive to burn it down. So the same is true in the financial markets. You allow corporations and companies to bet against a nation's debt or a corporation's debt to the extent that now they have an incentive to damage it. That's not a very good thing. There's a hazard there that we're...
These are called derivatives.
Derivatives, correct.
And most of these derivatives... Are purchased with borrowed money, leveraged?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's another whole end of it that you just look at, just lying out there, just waiting to do something.
Waiting to explode.
Waiting to do something bad, right?
Wait. Well, and this is the thing. You know, it's like walking in a minefield. And yes, is it possible that we could walk through this minefield and not step on a mine? Yes, it is.
Possible.
But it seems as though now we've gotten to the densest part. You know, in the past 20 years, there's always been one little outlying thing that you could, you know, the Dutch boy could put his finger in the hole. Okay, that's it. The dike is not leaking. But now there's so many holes. They're running out of fingers. And I have to wonder, where do they reach the point where something is like the juggler? I can do three. I can do four. Watch, I can do five. But the more every time I add a ball into the air, the more likelihood that one of them is going to fall.
So this is something that a president, a Congress, a Federal Reserve Board, a Federal Reserve Bank, nobody can really control.
No.
Because they're just out there. It's the Wild West.
Especially when you have an attitude to begin with that, okay, now I'm going to put aside, you've heard the old saying, you're going to cut off your nose to spite your face.
Right.
When you put aside all of the real reason for being in government. You know, you go ask a typical congressman, and I say typical, or congresswoman, what their goal is this year, and they express it in two words. You ready? You know what they are. Stop Trump. That's their goal. Yeah. Stop Trump. Mm-hmm. I don't care if what he's doing is good for the country. I don't want him to do it. I want to stop him. I want to thwart him. And I want to fight against him. When both parties, I hate to even use that term, you know, from the very beginning I've called them Demopublicans and Republicrats. When opposing sides will put aside their personal differences for the sake of the nation and work together to improve the nation, that's an ideal situation. The rest of the time, you want to kind of debate and argue, go ahead. But, you know, for the important stuff, you have to put aside your partisanship and work together. That's what this nation is all about. But I think for the first time in a long time, we have this hyper-partisanship where one side won't even listen to the other, let alone work together and compromise. So that is the most dangerous time for a for a nation. People will throw out the baby with the bathwater.
The attention span is so short, and the lack of people willing to listen is so limited that anytime you hear any kind of conversation, they don't even let the other person finish, and
they're just interrupting.
Yes. Nobody's hearing anybody.
Shrill.
It's just...
Yeah, man, screaming. Just, and I guess the model for that is UC Berkeley, right?
Sure.
Where, you know, if somebody comes to campus to address the students and their message is not liked, they're shouted down. They're driven out.
Yeah.
They're not allowed to speak. It's like, oh, you shouldn't even be allowed
it's
to say that.
Bonkers, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's bonkers. What's going on?
The idea that free speech, it means anyone should be able to express any view, no matter how hateful or disgusting it is. As I was taught when I was a kid, it was, I may not agree with what you say, but I will defend to my death your right to say it. And now it's like, I don't agree with what you say, so I'm going to kill you. Shut up.
Are we going to stop you from speaking?
We don't want to hear your message. You know, and it reminds me of the kids with the fingers in their ears. La, 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 la. Right? I don't hear you. You cannot. It is that debate and that absolute ability to speak your mind, no matter how insulting, revolting, disgusting your ideas are. Because if they're squelched, then suddenly people think, oh, why are they being prevented from saying this? Must be something to it. Now it draws more attention to it than if you were to just allow a healthy debate, you know, talk about it, defend your position, and be ready to impugn the other guy's position.
Yeah. It takes me back. I used to have some cassettes of the Federalists, and they were arguing about whether to have control in Washington or control in the states, which is a big deal.
Sure,
right?
It was a big deal.
Big deal.
States' rights.
It was amazing that the eloquent arguments and they let the person live.
Yeah.
And then they would come back and they say, well, you said this, but what about this? And
right.
It was really
debate.
Wonderful stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, great. I got goosebumps when
I heard.
The
like, Federalist Papers and Federalist. The Anti-Federalist Papers. So
in
that day, arguments were put forth in letters to the editor, so to speak. And, you know, these letters to the editor would get people thinking, and then another letter would, you know, get in the newspaper and express the opposing point of view. And sooner or later, it would coalesce into a majority opinion. That's what this republic was all about.
Yeah, but boy, it's not close to that.
Nowhere near that.
Isn't it curious, too, Andrew Goss, how this country's been around theoretically imposing democracy around the world, and it's almost like it's come back on us, and we're like third world countries now with our political intercourse.
Well, I know when I went to Hawaii in 2009, my first visit to Hawaii, and I learned from the local natives that their nation pretty much turned on its head once the missionaries arrived.
Sure, they'll save them, right?
Yeah, we're going to save you. Now, you know, these folks had the best of intentions. I'm not saying
they believe that if you don't believe
what I believe, you're going straight to, well.
Yeah.
So this fervor, because if I thought that if you didn't believe what I believe, Patrick, that something bad would happen to you, then I would spend, you know, my greatest energy and effort to convince you and to persuade you that this is what you needed to believe. So the fervor with which these folks conducted their affairs was dramatic. Mm-hmm. And the further you go back in history, the more drama you see, right, with the missionaries. And, oh, we need to purify. How are we going to do that in the witch trials? Yeah, let's burn her. If she's a witch, she'll save herself, and we'll know she's a witch.
So. I think to this day you really can't even, they somehow manage to keep it in effect in Hawaii where you can't even really own land, right?
Oh, in Hawaii.
Yeah. So it's still...
It's because the royal family.
The royal family.
And their ownership.
King Kamehameha. Well, I guess if somebody was going to do like a Time Newsweek cover about money... It would have to be Bitcoin, right? In 17.
Who?
Bitcoin.
What?
Cryptos.
Never heard of it.
Crypto, I know, never heard of it. Our first email is about it, and this is from a listener. Aside from the fact that Bitcoin and the like are the ultimate and unbacked currencies, the problem for Bitcoin is that a number of companies are working on blockchains that do not require the huge and ever-increasing power usage issues. Texas Instruments is one of these working on a hardware that they've already several years of experience manufacturing ultra low power digital signal processors. I wonder if Andrew has read they owned it all, including you by means of toxic currency by McDonald and Rowan. Any thoughts? Is this why we are listed as tenants on property deeds?
Yeah. Huh. And referred to as tenants.
Mm. So let's just do big picture cryptos. What do you think is going on here, big picture, though? I mean, there's something monumental going on, and I'm not sure exactly what it is. Something big with this blockchain, and I don't know of cryptos. But, well, what's your thoughts on it? Just big picture, if you're looking back in the last couple of years.
Okay, so I posted a post on our internal bulletin board where we post bids. I want to buy a $20 gold piece, and I'm willing to pay X amount of dollars. So we post these open bids, and then others sell us the coins. And on this teletype I posted last week, buying physical Bitcoin, please quote. And I got like dozens of responses from other dealers like, wait a minute, there's physical Bitcoins. Well, no, that's the whole point. There is no physical substance. So, and I, in the 80s and late 70s, I would talk about our rush towards a cashless society. And now we're embracing a monetary form that actually has no substance. I get it that the paper fiat money has no substance, but you can go to the bank and say, give me that paper dollar, give me those four quarters. Now I have a physical dollar in my possession. These cryptocurrencies have no physical equivalent, and this is the change. I think the rush to a cashless society, what I call the last 4%, 96% of everything we call money is electronic in nature. But the things the banks hate the most is their citizens and depositors coming to the bank and saying, give me my money in the form of cash. And they don't have enough to settle all their claims. So with the cryptocurrencies, they don't need to have enough. There is no such thing as enough because there is no physical element that has to be handed over. So this, I think, conditioning to the idea that there is no physical money, even though the supply is limited, there's no physical replacement for the electronic item, will finish us off, if you will. That last 4% of transactions that involve cash, what were they needed for? Well, they were needed by the health guru who takes drugs, or the physical fitness coach that maybe takes plastic surgery as a method of improving their appearance. You know, never mind washboard abs given to you by working. Rather, we're going to give you washboard abs by surgery. Now, that wouldn't be very good for them, publicity-wise, if all of their followers said, wait a minute, you got those abs how? By going to the doctor and letting them operate, well, you're telling me I have to do crunches. So we want to keep that transaction secret. Mm-hmm. So when that fitness guru goes to his plastic surgeon, he wants to be able to pay anonymously. He wants to pay him with cash. Now, I'm making that extreme example because drug dealers, money launderers, people who are escaping the taxation in their countries, Russia, very famously, China, the majority of Bitcoin transactions, as I understand it.
A lot of it in China.
The majority of Bitcoin transactions come out of China. Why? Because they're used to an oppressive regime who will take their physical money. And here they're given an opportunity to escape taxation, escape scrutiny, and you get all those wonderful things that was previously only possible by the 4%. The 4% of our money supply that is in physical cash. That enabled you to conduct these anonymous transactions. This is why the cryptocurrencies took off in the first place. If you recall, the revelation of Bitcoin even in existence came as a result of the Silk Road drug case,
right,
where they were using the internet, using the Bitcoin as the payment method, and conducting massive transactions involving illegal drugs. And they busted, arrested this guy, and the government could not hack into his wallet and get his Bitcoin.
To this day, I think he's got $25 million in there that they can't get at.
In cold storage, right, as I understand it, you simply print out your blockchain on a piece of paper and lock that piece of paper in a safe somewhere, and you're safe.
Yeah, I think the theory is on these wallets, if I understand it.
The cold storage.
Is the long, 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 long password that you would put in a piece of paper and have about five of them that
Correct.
You planted five different places. If you lose that, you're broke. If nobody finds that, then you're safe.
Well, that a friend of mine was talking about an article in the Wall Street Journal, I believe, last week about a gentleman who had engaged a supercomputer because he forgot his password, lost his password, and couldn't retrieve his Bitcoins. Another had thrown the hard drive away, and it was in a city dump, and he literally had people hired on the payroll sorting through the garbage looking for this thing because it was worth so much money now.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is that double-edged sword that it's secure, but it's secure even from you. And unlike a central-issued currency, what is touted as the blessing is actually a curse. And again, the last 4% of the cash market, so the last need for physical cash, is being met by cryptocurrencies. And once that need is fully met, then the elimination of cash will be just a small step away.
Yeah, and you just won't see it anymore. So maybe the Time magazine cover would be more, rather than Bitcoin, would be blockchain. Now, that's a thing that's here to stay.
That's right.
That is like, but just give us, just briefly, I know you tend to tell us how to make a clock when we
clock.
Say, when we ask you what time it is. But just, can you help us understand what blockchain is as compared to what it is, really? Why do we know?
No, I don't claim to be, I can't
you don't
claim
understand.
To be an it's, expert, except to say that... A blockchain is a series of numbers that are added to each time a transaction occurs. So, like right now, you buy a used car, and they tell you there were three owners. And you really don't know. And they got this new thing, Carfax, right? And this is the previous owner, and this is the one before
right.
that.
Yeah.
Now imagine if you bought a used car, and it was its activities were tracked on an open ledger. This is the day that the car was bought.
Patrick got into an accident in 63.
Correct. Yeah, and then this ledger, this chain of the ownership and what happened to the car was kept so that you now, as the 10th owner, could see the nine owners before, how many miles each of them put on it, where they drove it, what they did in terms of service, and so on. Then your verifiable open ledger enables you to make a better decision about that car.
Mm-hmm.
That's what an open ledger is. Right now, you had it, the guy before had it, you bought it, and you take it as it is without any knowledge of its previous...
Well, isn't that going to be a good thing for the tax guys?
Yeah.
Right.
It'll be a great thing for the tax guys.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be a good thing for the car buyers? Yeah, it's going to be a great thing for the car. Is it going to encourage people to keep more meticulous records of, or actually take care of their item? Yeah, it might encourage more maintenance in vehicles. But that's just one example. The same thing now can be taken across everything else. You know, the tracking of food shipments, the keeping of medical records. So blockchain,
wow,
as I understand
everything.
Everything. Everything. Yeah. As I understand it, the idea of an open ledger that's verifiable is here to stay. That's the big revolution.
It's a bit Orwellian in a where, you know, they see Andrew get a, you know, get a traffic ticket 5 years from now, and they just pop up and they can tell if Andrew's on any medication.
Oh, sure.
When's the last time you took your medication?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, it will boom, 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 boom.
Everything, Orwellian, open ledger.
A very Orwellian kind of thing.
Like living in a fishbowl. Yeah. Everything will be transparent, and the record of everything will be transparent.
And we had a past guest who studies this stuff with healthcare, and she says that's where it's all going. That's what the government wants.
Oh, sure.
It's a single payer.
Yep.
Everything. Every little nook and cranny of your life and your health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably to the fact if you can tie it in with your refrigerator genetic, with what you're buying. I mean, what kind of food you're buying, right? Well, yeah, we're going to tax you more because you like, you know, Oreos.
Well, yeah, but somebody somebody who eats according to their blood type or according to their, right? I mean, these types of sciences exist where you shouldn't eat this, but you should eat that.
Right.
Oh, you're from here, so you should eat something else.
Sure.
And whether or not you stay to that diet will determine your physical well-being.
In theory.
So, has he deviated or drifted from that? Well, with a single payer.
You got to check mark against.
You got to check mark against, so now you're going to have to pay a tax, a greater tax.
But, you know, you could see how these people could do
to
that
control
kind of
human
stuff.
Behavior, blockchain will be the ultimate hammer.
Whoa.
That government and industry.
It's hard to even navigate the web. When you go through things, I saw where Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan, I guess, they're getting into a trading desk on the on the blockchain or the
blockchain technology. I heard a beverage company. Did you hear this one?
No.
The beverage company changed its name from Long Island.
To blockchain. And the stock just skyrocketed.
People just, it's blockchain, I'm buying it.
I saw an article the other day where a fellow is figuring out how to heat his home with while he mines his computers, and that's pretty clever.
That is clever.
Yeah, because it does produce.
But I wonder, so there's 17 million bitcoins now in existence.
Seven, is it? I don't know.
Yeah. I thought it was 17.
Already? No, they're not that close, are they?
No,
so they're 21?
Yeah, I thought so.
Really?
And 21 is the total that
that's what they say. That's what they say.
So I guess when they hit 21 million, throw your hardware away.
That's right.
Yeah. And then does the cost of a transaction now rise accordingly? It's my understanding that in the latest roller coaster, which has been over the last 6 or 7 days.
Yeah, it was up to about 20,000 now. It went down to 11. It was like a huge hit the last.
Huge hit. But the cost.
But they're back up to 15.
But the cost to process a transaction actually went up to like $50.
Really?
So imagine if you're
I didn't know that.
Neiman Marcus.
So if you're buying, it costs you $50
more? $50 to do the transaction.
Really?
So if you're Neiman Marcus and you're selling your items for Bitcoin, and you wrote all your prices up when Bitcoin was 19,000 to the dollar, and now your consumer comes in and he has to buy a $300 sweater with Bitcoin. It's going to cost him $50 more for the transaction, and then by the time you get your fraction of a Bitcoin, it's going to be worth half as much or a third of or two-thirds of what it was when you received it. So it makes it very difficult to price your goods and services in this currency if it's going to fluctuate like
this. It's really interesting. I can recall 6-7 years ago when Bitcoin started, you were talking about, well, if people start really using Bitcoins to buy things, this thing may have some legs.
That's correct.
I remember.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of falling out of favor, that whole idea.
You don't need to buy anything.
Yeah, nobody's really talking about that. I mean, I know
that you're just going to buy it because it's going up.
Yeah, I know that, you know, Tesla was saying.
It's just a pure speculating vehicle.
Yeah, I think they're kind of. However, I did read, didn't I, that Bezos and Amazon are going to start doing some things in Bitcoin?
Let them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if Jeff Bezos can sell a $10 book and you could pay with Bitcoin, even if it cost you $50, I mean, he would almost have to be willing to put a zero value on his book right. and give it away, just like they did the free shipping. And he says, oh, well, no transaction fees. Mm-hmm. So,
Mike Maloney writes an email or just released an episode of his Hidden Secrets of Money. It's all about cryptocurrency. I didn't really understand how they worked either until I watched this. Just search Hidden Secrets of Money, episode 8. Oh, okay.
Yeah, sure. I'll do that right away.
I'll do it right, too. Does Andrew know if anyone currently is carrying on in the steps of Eustace Mullins and doing some independent investigations of the world order? Did Eustace have any disciples, proteges?
Well, I claim to be one. I certainly, I loved Eustace. I knew him well. And he led me on a bunch of different trails. Are there others like me? Maybe. We don't have a club or anything.
You don't have a club.
Yeah, Eustace Mullins is probably one of the great original thinkers. And even today when I see some of these lately guys quoting from his Secrets of the Federal Reserve, his list of the original shareholders and suggesting that these are the shareholders of the Federal Reserve, I mean, they're just lifting the man's research without giving him any credit. You know, any list of owners of the Federal Reserve that includes Lehman Brothers is obviously stolen from Eustace Mullins. They don't even exist anymore. Or Shearson.
Here's Mike in Washington for Andrew Goss. Andrew, Andy has in the past recommended an older book on bills and notes. Could he give us that title again? I hear of an internal coin offering today raising the most money in the so-called so far that specifically promises nothing, no share in the company, no promising. Promise they would be bought back in the future.
Right.
I guess it's one of the another ICOs.
Yeah, ICO, an initial coin offering.
They're happening every day now.
They are happening every day, and this one, as he is pointing out, has, what is it, no share in the company that's issuing it, no promise that they could be bought back in the future, nothing, and still they're selling out.
And why would you buy that?
Because they're going up.
Oh, good.
Haven't you heard?
Mm-hmm.
Bitcoin went up 17,000%, so here we have Nipcoin, and that one's going to be better. Mm-hmm. So you should buy that, because that company did great. This one's going to do great. These initial coin offerings are essentially Patrick and Andy say, oh, we're going to issue 10,000 Patrick Andy coins, and if 11,000 people buy them, they're going to go up in price. Mm-hmm. And it's just that simple.
Yeah, just like a carnival. Just like being at a carnival.
Uh-huh.
Just like being
and
at
the
a
Barkers, come and try.
Just
come
like
and
being
see.
At a carnival.
For me, you know, the as I boil down investments to those three things, back in the day when I came up with this formula, I would tell people, oh, you're going to buy stock? You're going to buy stock in a mining company? Well, make sure you get the physical shares, right? Make them register the shares in your name.
Get the piece of paper.
And
like
mail them to you. That way they can't short sale, where you would call your broker, I want to buy 100 shares of Company B. Oh, yeah, sure, I'm going to write you down. You own 100 shares of Company B. Did that broker buy Company B? No. He shorted them and said, Andy's out of his mind. Those shares are never going to go up. I'm just going to tell him he owns them. And when they go down, I'll just give him half his money back. So the same is true now once you... physical possession being one of the three big rules, right? I boil down for if you're going to buy a coin, in my case, an American gold and silver coin, well, you need A, to assure yourself of the authenticity. And in the case of Bitcoin, right, that's the blockchain thing. You're assured of the authenticity of this data that you just paid $17,000 for. You paid $17,000 for a string of numbers, and they're put together in such a way that they are unique. So, and you've paid $17,000 for this string of numbers. Well, then you take possession of that string of numbers. Mm-hmm. All of the same things that apply. Take physical possession, check the price, confirm the authenticity. They apply to everything. And just about anything you buy as an investment, if you'll do those three things, then your odds of not being defrauded are pretty great. But if you leave any one of those things undone, why then fraud can creep into the equation. And nowhere do I worry about it more than the advent of the cryptocurrencies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the selling point of the system is that miners, Bitcoin miners, with their computing power, validate this long string of numbers. Yes, we've followed it from its creation to now, and we affirm that it's valid. And for that, they earn a Bitcoin or a fraction of a Bitcoin. And the more people that are doing it, obviously, the less it's worth. So the computing power is constantly increasing as more people are doing it. But my question then gets to be, well, when we get to the 21st million Bitcoin and it's no longer possible to mine any new ones, then what's going to be the incentive then for all this computing power to validate your Bitcoin transaction?
Well, somebody's going to have to pay for that.
Somebody's going to have to pay. Exactly.
That's
right.
Interesting. So you've said you think then the dollar will someday go on a blockchain.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How would that change things for our listeners this morning on this December 27 day? How would that change things? Would it change it at all? I guess it would be faster.
It's more
disciplined. You could transfer money between here and your Uncle Tony in Italy.
Who needs much faster.
An operation.
And discipline. Yeah. So I've joked in the past, half joked, that your deposit in your bank account is visible to you when you log into your bank account. So imagine the bank's computer. Uh-oh, here's Patrick logging into his bank account.
Let him show him something.
Let's quickly transfer some digits in there. Okay, he's done looking. He's logging off. Take him back out. And so this...
What? Now they can really do that.
Oh, they can. Of course they can. So
literally give those digits to somebody else?
But correct.
Why would you even have to move them if they're just a picture of...
For the balance sheet. They couldn't be in two places at one time, the total number of digits. So I believe blockchain will help these banks to manage that to the nth degree.
That's pretty curious. Yeah. So like they do now...
Sweeping your money every night, sending it to China, letting it work all night in China, bringing it back in the morning.
Sure.
I wrote a newsletter in the mid-90s called The River of Money. And the River of Money was this pipe that ran under the Hudson River from New Jersey to the World Trade Centers. And the River of Money every night would be aggregated in that trade center and then sent across the world to the other side of the world. So while we were sleeping, our money, not for us, but for the banks that were doing the aggregation, was literally working all night in China and then coming back to the United States the following day before we woke up. And the question I was postulating, what happens if the River of Money runs dry? Right now, you're expecting your money to come back in the morning and it doesn't come back. Could it be replicated or duplicated? And this is essentially what the banks are doing now. Because if you look at that Fred computer and the total supply of money in everyone's checking account, etc., somewhere around $15 trillion.
MZM, right?
Right.
I'll pull it up now. You're talking. Yeah. It would be Fred MZM, right?
Yeah, but that money's in three places at the same time. I mean, in reality, there is no $15 trillion in money stock that is available for instant withdrawal.
I see. It's just not there.
It's just not there, and it just keeps going up. Yes.
What is it? 15?
Almost 16. Now, well, 15.
15.2 trillion. Yeah. Okay. But I mean, that even though that's what you call hot money or money with a zero maturity.
Yes.
If everybody went out to get that 15 trillion tomorrow,
it wouldn't be there.
It just wouldn't be there.
They would have to create it. I mean, in reality.
It'd be like Jimmy Stewart and
How much do you really need
today?
And when we were dealing with a physical money supply in a paper sense, and it's funny because, remember, the paper was representing the gold and silver coin.
Yeah. We have digits
representing the paper. Yeah.
Oh my God.
What's the problem now? Yeah. Is that there's not enough paper for everyone to get paid. So how are we going to solve this problem? We're going to eliminate the paper. So in the past, we eliminate the gold. Eliminate the paper.
Now we're going to eliminate the paper.
And how do you see the cryptocurrencies? Not one of them has a physical, here's my physical cryptocurrency.
No.
It's a piece of paper. It's a other than a long digit.
A piece of just numbers.
No way to authenticate it. Mm-hmm. It's much more complicated than it was in the Western movies where you'd pay somebody with a $20 gold piece and they would bite it and go, that's gold. Now, how are you going to authenticate your data? You know, in God we trust, All others bring data. Never mind cash. We don't want cash anymore. Where's your data? Let me see your long string of numbers.
And you could just see like Matt Dillon on his horse with with an iPhone, you know,
trying to authenticate. You just gave me a string of numbers. Wait a minute. This string of numbers is not authentic.
It's just not authentic.
How can I tell?
Here's an email for you. Andrew just talked about in the first hour of today's show about the decline of the value of the U.S. dollar over 2017, according to the USD index. Shouldn't inflation, the value of goods, services, wages, etc., be correlated somehow in the value of the USD,
yes,
the currency in which this inflation is calculated,
yes,
first and foremost, as per this index, and shouldn't people be guided mainly by the index in their investment decisions rather than the fairy tales that they've heard read about inflation quarterly and annually?
That's very good. Mm. That is very good, because I liken that to when you're looking at that dollar index value pure, you see it's very obvious from 104 down to 93, or from 93 up to 104. But looking at the consumer price index or the producer price index or the other traditional measures of inflation is like looking in the rearview mirror instead of driving by looking out of the windshield. So looking in the rearview mirror and seeing what the effects of this loss of dollar substance are. Hmm. That's what the CPI and PPI are. And unfortunately, because Americans are unfamiliar with this, I mean, imagine if you went into your boss's office and said, if you had a boss, hey, boss, you know, the dollar went from 104 to 93 this year, so it's lost 10% of its value. I need a 10% raise. You'd know exactly what to ask for. And it doesn't happen that way. And it's why I say that it's causing Americans to misprice their goods and services, and I don't believe that's by accident.
Uh-huh.
So, again, another newsletter from years ago, the CPI and other fairy tales. It is an absolute fallacy to conduct your business affairs or to expect that this consumer price index or the producer price index will give you an accurate reflection of inflation. You're much better off to use something like the dollar index. And what companies try to convince people is that our growth will outpace this inflation rate, and that's ultimately the best you can hope for.
888-663-6386, email Patrick at 1radionetwork.com. We're getting Christmas greetings for you and all that.
Thank you, everyone.
Best wishes,
yes, thank you. And best wishes for, you know, merry everything and happy ever after is what I vote for.
Happy ever after. Steve writes in Lynchburg, Virginia, looking at the MZM chart on Fred.
Thank you.
Why does it say it represents billions of dollars, not trillions? Obviously, 16 billion sounds too low considering Apple has 80, but just wondering why it does not say the chart denotes trillions, not billions. Copy and paste it below from Fred. Oh, I see.
Well, it's just the gauge. Yeah. If you had a speedometer in your car that had, you know, the first mark was zero and the second mark was 60, it would be, you know, difficult to gauge when you were going 30 miles an hour. It's somewhere in between zero and 60. So by doing it in millions of dollars, theoretically, they give you a more accurate measure that you couldn't see from a chart that was done in billions.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, it wouldn't take much space.
But they even do that on all the H4N1 report.
Yeah.
Right? It's always
it's
in
always
billions.
In millions, or it's billions. In billions, someday or it's in hundreds of thousands.
Someday it'll be in trillions.
Depends on the number. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as we add zeros, right? What I say about inflation is the only way this system will collapse is if they run out of zeros. So as they keep adding zeros, I believe very soon, if we don't already have the first trillionaire, I think we do.
Do we?
I think we do. I think it's the Rothschilds carousel group, but I don't know because it's private. So, you know, we Everett Dirksen, the congressman in the 40s and 50s, we used to say, a million here, a million there, pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Yeah.
And people have paraphrased that, a billion here, a billion there. You think about it, in the 40s and 50s, a millionaire was a big deal.
A
billionaire didn't exist. Now we got billionaires all over the place, and the millionaires, I think a trillionaire is not far behind, and will the Federal Reserve adjust its charts, perhaps it will. But that's the reason it's in billions of dollars, to give you a more accurate measure. The same way your thermometer goes up in individual degrees and your speedometer goes up in individual miles an hour. That's, I guess, in
the It's measure. December 27th. Andrew's here in the studio in Dripping Springs. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. The Masseys will be here tomorrow and then open phone Friday. I would like to hear Andy's views on hemp cannabis markets that are exploding in relation to the money supply.
Oh, yeah.
How is it that the largest cash crop and lots of money is still not put in banks due to it being illegal on a federal level? Also, the publication Popular Mechanics said,
which I don't believe,
it was the next billion-dollar crop and that it was in 1938 before the market was totally suppressed.
Yeah, the hemp market.
Wonder what it would be now. Also, cars can be set up to told fully run on hemp ethanol instead of corn.
Henry Ford.
And hemp is the non-GM, blah, blah, blah.
And okay. He, in fact, used hemp to make the component structures, I understand, like a synthetic fiberglass sort of a thing. So the cannabis markets, both for recreational use and clothing, and I mean, the uses are endless. Rope and it has tensile strength. It's one of those very useful substances. However, you can grow it in your yard. And very difficult for any complex to take control of something that you're just as likely to create as someone else is. So I think for this reason, I'm still not understanding why this was put on the same level as cocaine or heroin. It's not what people say the gateway drug. It's I mean, I know that people out there will argue, but marijuana is not an addictive substance, no more than anything else that you enjoy might be an addictive substance. If you smoke marijuana and you stop smoking it, I've known plenty of people that just made the choice, I'm going to stop smoking marijuana, and they stop. It's not like they go into convulsions and their body starts rejecting its very life. So I don't understand why it was made illegal in the first place. Yes, I believe it would be a boon to America if we took it off the schedule and just let individuals go back to the traditional uses for hemp, not just as a recreational drug. And the medicinal uses have been suppressed because it's an illegal substance. I think if the studies on cannabis would have been allowed to continue as they had since prior to 1938, that we would have found a bunch more uses for it than currently existed. But once again, it can't be controlled. It certainly can't be patented. And you can't be stopped from growing it on your land, just like any giant agribusiness could grow it on their land. Do I think it should be legalized? Yes, I do, just as I think everything else should be legalized and left up to the individual to decide.
Merry Christmas to you guys.
Merry Christmas.
Since bitcoins are not yet under the control of the government, what would prevent anyone from punching out a pile of physical bitcoins and then discounting them to the value of the digital versions, floating them around in cyberspace, maybe aluminum blanks?
Sure, and set up their own exchange bank where they say,
idea.
I'm going to take the bitcoin numbers and I'm going to put them in the vault here. And in the cold storage, I'm going to print out the numbers of the bitcoins, put them in the vault, and then I'm going to issue tokens.
Man, let's do that.
Yeah, let's do that.
I think.
And while we're at it, let's issue more tokens than we actually have bitcoins, and we'll just take fractional reserve banking into the next sphere.
Uh-huh.
Because, hey, who's ever going to bring their bitcoin to us and say, give me the piece of paper, give me the digit string that represents this physical bitcoin? Hey.
But we know
those that fail to study history are condemned to repeat it. Was that George Santayana? I know he wrote a bunch of better things than that, but that's the one he's remembered for. If you study history, you'll find that that's just how the Federal Reserve came into existence. Exactly. But we're going to print out these pieces of paper that are easier to carry.
Sure.
They're uniform. They're the same throughout the country. And you can bring them back to the bank anytime and get your physical digit string. I see this as a natural evolution. Maybe you should try that. Patrick loved that idea
much. I want to do
so. He's ready to do it already.
Buy
a Bitcoin, and then maybe you issue 17,000 individual Bitcoin aluminum punched out tokens that you can say, oh, this is 1/17,000th of a Bitcoin.
Yeah.
There is no substance, folks. Get that. Since there's no substance, no weight and measure, a $20 gold piece, you know, is an ounce of gold. That's what it's supposed to be anyway.
I wonder if, what if somebody would do a blockchain crypto thing and then have it gold? I mean, that would be valuable, wouldn't it, in some way? It
defeats its purpose, though.
What? It'd be easier to trade and send out your...
If we did this gentleman's scheme, or it could be lady, forgive me. So your scheme would suppose counterparty risk, right? The value of your stamped out Bitcoin token would be reliant upon the issuing authority to maintain the adequate reserves of Bitcoin.
It always goes back.
Yes, that's exactly correct. Well, this is one of those pure elements of money that there is no counterparty risk to a $20 gold piece. If you take a $20 gold piece, you put it in your vault, you own it, it's in your control. No one else can replicate it, duplicate it, or sell it, or do anything with it.
That's been your argument with what you do, from the very beginning.
That's why I do what I do.
You have it in your underwear drawer,
you're safe.
And
it's yours.
It's yours, and nobody...
Nobody can do futures,
nobody can
options,
ever say,
contracts.
Sorry,
I can't give you that. I can't make the value of that $20 coin good because I'm broke. So that's your counterparty risk. The issuing authority of these physical Bitcoin aluminum blanks is the one that you have to trust. And as long as they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, then everything's fine. It's only when they stop doing what they're supposed to be doing that the troubles creep in. There's your counterparty risk.
Yeah. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Let's see here. Hold on a second. Doodle, get over here. Here's an email from Matthew. How about a good old-fashioned silver price prediction for mid-2018? Some of the sensible pundits are now calling for a move up. Sensible pundits?
As I've said before, predicting is easy, except when it involves the future. So I can't. I wish I could tell you, other than to say that the supply of silver is overwhelmed by the demand for silver, and every single smart element that's put into the stream, from your smart refrigerators to your security system, name it, the little electronic Internet of Everything device that you're buying, it contains a little bit of silver. And unlike gold, it's not recoverable. So when the device is broken, it really makes no sense to recover the silver from it. It's only in the solder and so forth, so you throw it away. Oh, the question on bills and notes. Norton's bills and notes. Get a copy of it if you can. It'll get you through things, at least understanding the difference between a bond, a bill, and a note.
Something that's been talked a lot about that you had a very interesting take on, that the corporate, I would say, leftist media is kind of turning around in this whole net neutrality thing. It's really curious, isn't it, that what we're hearing out there on the mainstream media is that net neutrality, that President Trump just appointed somebody in the FCC to stop this so-called net neutrality law, is going to be bad for neutrality and bad for freedom of speech. And you're suggesting that that's not the case.
I don't think it is, no. And, you know, I would liken it to a highway. So we're all going to pitch in and we're going to build this highway because we all need to get from point A to point B. And so we build the highway and we throw it open to anyone who wants to use it. And we're not going to restrict access in any way. And the next thing you know, the commercial users, the trucks and the taxis and everybody are using it to the exclusion of the individual that paid for it. And this is the thing with net neutrality, that you cannot say, oh, no, you can't drive that tractor trailer on here. You can't bring a line of tractor trailers on here. You can't use this highway for commercial activity, that it's only for individual use.
Uh-huh.
That's where the driver's license came from. That's where the car registration came from. That's where the term driver came from. So you're engaged in commercial activity when you drive.
Hmm.
You're not moving your property on the public road. You're using the public road for a commercial benefit. Right now, there's no regulation. Or, in net neutrality, Netflix has as much right to stream movies as you do to send an email to your Aunt Betty. Mm-hmm. And should your email to Aunt Betty or Netflix's movie be given any priority? No. It has to, access to either one of them has to be neutral. So as a result, everyone suffers. If the operator or the service provider was able to say, oh, no, Netflix, you're making money from streaming that movie, so you're going to have to pay more for access than Joe, who's just writing an email to his Aunt Betty. Mm-hmm. Well, then things could develop much further. But right now, the internet service providers are forced to take this traffic without any regard for who it is or what they're doing, and they have to be completely neutral. And it doesn't matter what the traffic is, where it comes from, it's very democratic, very socialist to suggest everyone has the same access. But in reality, it really stifles competition.
So that's why, in my situation, why I have an internet provider that has problems and it drops out from time to time, as people know,
right?
Because I'm through the air.
Yeah.
And the wire only goes, I think as far as it comes is about 10 miles away from me, the copper.
Right.
You're saying that with this net neutrality off, people might be likely to run some copper down my street now because they can charge me more.
Sure.
Or before they couldn't.
Couldn't before. Couldn't.
Yeah. No. So that's actually, again, when government tries to get in there and make things at a level playing field, it usually screws things
it
up.
It benefits one group at the expense of another.
At the expense of another.
And so now what the elimination of net neutrality is saying, it's like a user
fee. Patrick wants to pay more, let him pay.
Or if Netflix is going to hog up the bandwidth, then they should have to pay more than the guy who's just sending an email
to
his Aunt Betty.
So this net neutrality kibosh thing that President Trump did, we consumers will end up paying more for stuff.
We'll pay more for everything.
Pay more for everything.
But it will allow for the Internet of Things. I mean, that's what's happening. And then without the incentive to provide a traffic pattern or to provide a conduit for this traffic to travel, the net neutrality, we don't care how much you clog up our pipe, you have access to this.
And isn't it interesting how they've used the term, which is exactly opposite of what it does.
Like the Bank Secrecy Act.
Like the Bank Secrecy Act.
And all these things. Strips away all secrecy from banking.
Strips away all secrecy. Isn't it clever the way they do that?
The Federal Reserve Act.
Federal Reserve.
They're not federal. They have no reserves.
isn't that funny?
Yep.
I think you're going to like this one. Okay, so the people in South Africa actually listened to the show. Because here's what they're going to do.
Yep.
They said, the Economic Transformation Committee told reporters that the National Executive Committee is going to seek an amendment to the Constitution to allow for land exploration and that South Africa's ruling party has accepted a proposal that the central bank should be wholly state-owned rather than by institution with private shareholders.
Amen.
So here's a place in South that they're going to they're going to own their own central bank.
Sure, and they should.
They should.
I think the issuing authority should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it rightly belongs.
Isn't that hilarious?
Oh, excuse me. That was not me. That was Thomas Jefferson.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're gonna have their own. They're gonna have their own thing.
And you know, here in the United States, the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac solution is what we said. Oh well, we're just it's true that we allow the banks and connected people to monetize debt instruments, and that gives them a leg up on the average Joe who maybe doesn't have that ability. So we're going to create a federal national mortgage association.
Fannie Mae.
And they're going to give mortgages to the regular working folks in this country who aren't connected politically to the banks, who rely strictly upon their character to determine who they're going to give money to and who they aren't.
Mm-hmm. Patrick Timpone, Andrew Goss, OneRadioNetwork.com. We'll take a few more emails here. Question on the Red Book coin valuation from Gordon in Bristol, New Hampshire.
Sure.
A 1923 Double Eagle in PGS holder with a grading of MS63. When I bought the coin in 2015, the Red Book placed a value of 1850. The Red Book now, 2018, puts a value of 1600. Looking at the price of gold per ounce over the time period, I don't see how that amount of price change, excluding some of the sharp peaks and lows. How do the Red people weigh in with that number?
Like, well, okay. Premium and dispremium. So typically speaking, in a rising gold market, such as the one we're entering right now, the premium above the price of gold for these generic coins starts to increase. And in a falling coin market, such as the one we're just leaving, the premium becomes smaller. So in a falling gold market, the premium that people are willing to pay over spot falls. Mm-hmm. And in a rising gold market, the premium rises. So that's why I've said in the past that when you buy something like a rare $20 gold piece, well, like the coin he's talking about, uh-huh. not only can you make money from the increase in the price of gold, but you also make money from the increase in the premium over gold. So I remember 1989, an MS65 $20 gold piece was worth like 10 times, if I'm remembering correctly, 450, 40, well, about 8 times its gold content. And now you can buy a Mint-State 65. And when in the peak when gold was 1900 just recently, these things were double. Now you could buy a MS-65 $20 gold piece for about a 50% premium over its actual gold content. Mm-hmm. So the premium rises when the metals rise, and the premium falls when the metals fall. And the same is true for the silver dollars. Again, all of the generic, or what we've called in the past semi-numismatic coins, where the bulk of the value is in the gold or the silver, they're more susceptible to the supply and demand equation. The very rare coins are immune from it all. They don't care whether the price of gold is rising or falling. The supply and demand strictly dictate their value. So those are the so-called numismatic coins, where the bulk of the value is in the collectability or in the scarcity, and not in the gold or the silver content.
Do you think overall, as a coin dealer, of you've been at this 35 years plus, the more crypto kind of whatever things they come up with, it should be good for your business, where more solid things that you can put in your
real things
yeah. are going to be more valuable.
Well, yeah. I mean
overall, it must, right?
Look what's happening.
Even
with
though
food.
you've probably lost some investors who just want to get rich and buy
Bitcoin. Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You probably lost some.
Oh goodness.
But
yeah.
That's probably short. That's
I even
probably,
talked about
that's probably
a couple of months ago
a short thing,
an investor
right?
that sold off his gold dollar collection so that he could buy.
Sure. Because there are people that are going to do that because they want to get in. Right. But overall, just like you said with real food, overall organic food is right. going to be worth more money 5 years from
Correct.
Now just because it's real.
Yeah, and right? real things.
Real things.
Versus synthetic things.
Yeah, synthetic things will be worth more money, right?
Sure.
They have to be.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a natural progression of things.
My daughter-in-law, I love her, Brooke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
I know Brooke.
I went to see Brooke. I look at her barbecue grill.
Yeah.
This thing is like stainless, built like a tank. I've got a $200 barbecue grill that's built, yeah, it looks the same. But boy, when you start looking at the components, you realize quickly the steel is thinner. It's not solid. Mm-hmm. Some of it's plated and mm-hmm. so forth. So you compare the two and you realize quickly that the real one operates better, works better. That's what she has. My fake one, it'll rust out in 2 years. You throw it in the trash.
Uh-huh.
So on every level, people are going for something real. You know, the shoes that'll last more than 2 months.
Yeah.
Or the whatever you buy, if you're going to have to replace it in 3 months, it's a false economy. So if you buy the best of something and the real thing, you're always better off. And I think the trend there, I mean, we've already gone the other way.
We've all gone the other way.
We've all gone the other way where
we
try to make
back,
things
right?
as cheap as we possibly can
uh-huh.
and sell them as cheap as we possibly can, and you get something that's as cheap as it can possibly
sure.
be. In the case of assets, especially with the advent of these ununderstandable financial instruments.
Ununderstandable. I like
ununderstandable.
Right, right.
The average person, I don't get that.
I don't get that.
How's that work?
I don't get a mortgage-backed security.
You know, I don't get that. Yeah, I'm just going to stick with this hunk of gold
uh-huh.
and put it in my safe. That is easy to understand. It's easy to buy. It's easy to sell. So
yeah, yeah.
I think that the pendulum is swinging towards real assets. real assets, and those who realize it sooner are going to benefit over those who realize it later. Hmm. Because especially in the case of a fixed supply item, once they're gone, that's it. Now we're only arguing about price.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess that's why, have the bookstores survived this whole thing? Do you think they'll survive?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. There's always going to be people want to hold.
Oh, one. Yeah.
Always going to be.
Yeah, I remember when that Kindle thing came out.
Yeah.
Somebody got me one.
Yeah.
And I was like, what?
I got one. I don't use it. I don't know.
Something about turning the page, going forward, going back. Yeah, I get it. It's almost like a real book. And I used to joke with when kids were little, the commercial was it tastes just like real fruit. Wow, why don't we just get the real fruit? And why do we want something that tastes just like it?
Hello, Patrick and Andy. This is from Amanda. Here's a video I'm enclosing. It's a company that sells precious metals to investors, and it 2008 was just a warning. They say when the next crisis hits, the bail-in laws that were written into the Dodd-Frank Act allow your deposits and assets to be used to recapitalize the banks.
Just your deposits.
Leaving your bankrupt and your banks back in good standing. And also, the laws are now in place that further insulate the banks during the next crisis. Reg D at the Fed allows banks to sweep the cash in your checking and savings account into sub-accounts in their name.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Well, that is true. That's what we were talking about in the last segment.
A recent Yale Law study shows that stocks, bonds, and mutual funds that you think you own are all held in street name.
Yeah, they're
with
you
as the beneficial
trust
owner.
Corporation.
As a real owner and assets. Just want to make sure that this is accurate.
It is accurate.
It is accurate.
However, I despise the use of fear as a sales tactics for coins.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, okay.
I don't,
I'm not faulting ITM Trading, which is the company that put out this video. However, the idea that you're going to scare someone into buying coins. You should buy gold coins because you don't really own your stocks and bonds, and you should buy, okay, maybe that's all true. The idea that you're left bankrupt and your bank gets to take your money, I disagree with that. What that law does is simply this. It allows you to be listed as a creditor instead of a depositor. So if the bank runs into trouble, and we take all the money that we have here, we have to pay our creditors, and we can only pay them 70 cents on the dollar, well, then that's what you get. You get 70 cents on the dollar instead of what you used to get, which was 100 cents on the dollar and even had an insurance fund to back it up, the FDIC. And in prior years, I've gotten in trouble for saying what I'm going to say right now. The FDIC is bankrupt.
Oh, go ahead.
They don't have enough money to cover all the deposits in their system, and, let alone a nationwide or system-wide collapse. Yes, and this is the caveat that'll keep me out of trouble, they have access to an unlimited Treasury credit line. Mm-hmm. So they can borrow from the Treasury, but in their insurance scheme, the way that it's currently established, there is no way that they could pay what they've lost.
Can you actually buy insurance to insure your money in the bank?
I can't. You can buy insurance for anything.
Oh, so you could go out to somebody like Lloyd's.
Say, I don't trust the
Lloyd's
FDIC.
Lloyd's and Linden. I've got $10 million.
Yeah.
And I just don't trust
you. I don't trust
you could
the
do
bank.
That?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I'll be doing
That would be called a bespoke policy.
A bespoke?
Yes, custom made.
It'd be fun to be rich enough to have one of those.
Well,
wouldn't
it? It'd be fun to be rich enough to need one.
That's what I mean.
I don't trust the FDIC and not much money.
I'm going to get my own insurance.
Custom made.
Hi, Patrick. Topical that Hillary Clinton is receiving protection from the deep state, as explained by Andy a couple of weeks ago. Would you mind asking Andy about, Hillary Clinton's previous role in investigating the killing of JFK? I can't find any links only to the Watergate investigation. I'm trying to understand why Hillary is being protected. Perhaps Andy can explain a bit more.
Well. You'd have to, I guess the one thing that maybe would help to shed light on this for you a little bit more, of course, the Rose Law Firm. And they were very careful in the past to mention Hillary Rodham Clinton. And looking up Hugh Rodham and Mena, Arkansas, might shed a little more light on the subject for you. Let's just suffice it to say that while Mr. Trump's exposure to government and its workings has a 2-year history, prior to that it was all about being on the other side, trying to get things done in the private sector by taking care of those in the deep state, as he loves to talk about his campaign contributions and politicians begging him for money and the like. In the case of Hillary Rodham Clinton, her connections are from day one. And her involvement in prior, again, we could spend the next 2 hours to explain why she has a connection that Donald Trump doesn't have. She was born into it, and he just walked into it.
So, I mean, but she goes way back.
She was born into the whole thing. And the cooperation between the Demopublicans and the Republicrats, right, the globalists, was, I think, highlighted no more eloquently than in the cooperation between the Bush and Clinton dynasties. I believe they're both part of the same dynasty. And it is a continuation of the Fitzhugh and Rodham in the case of Kennedy and in the case of the Chicago family. Do your own research here. Look up Hugh Rodham, H-U-G-H, Rodham, and Mena, Arkansas, and the connections to Bill Clinton and Jackson Stevens and so on. So it's a tangled web, but you'll always find the connections being that they're dynastic, their fathers and their prior relatives, their relatives are included in this chain, and I think Hillary was right at the beginning of it all. And her connections to Watergate, remember, why were they in Watergate? Why were the burglars in the Watergate Democratic National Committee headquarters? Nixon already had a lead that was unbelievable. He was going to win in a landslide. His opponent, there was no chance. What the heck were the burglars doing in there? And why do the names of the Watergate burglars also figure into the three tramps that were arrested in Dealey Plaza in 1963? Well, because the reason they were in there was to gather the evidence that the DNC allegedly had of the Kennedy assassination and the involvement of people around Richard Nixon and George Bush.
Do you think the United States has more skeletons rattling around than other countries? Or is it pretty much, is it governments just do this for a living? I mean, this is what they do.
They do that, and then they spin their propaganda machines, their PR people, to tell his story, right? His story. Yeah. So I guess his story.
Is that where the word comes from?
I don't know.
I never even thought about it.
But I will say this, that if you compare the history books in the United States, the history books used in the South and the history books used in the North depicted American history differently. And the same is true. If you read the history books in Russia versus the history books in the United States talking about the Cold War. You know, in the American books, Russia is the aggressor, and boy, they're the evil one. And in the Russian history books, Americans are the aggressors and the evil ones. So each government has its interest in keeping its purity, and they do that by rewriting or writing the history books.
Then I guess they all create evildoers.
Oh, sure.
And so they can keep a strong military.
Oh, sure. 1984.
So Russia, I guess it's us.
And yeah.
Russia.
Yeah.
For us, it's
same
Russia.
As them, yeah.
And then now we have terrorism. And
sure, terrorism.
There'll probably be a new one after this one, I guess.
Well, the war on drugs. Don't forget that. That was before terrorism. So
right.
So we could do without.
We had the war on poverty, too, and Lyndon Johnson.
We did, yes. Caused us to spend way more money than we should have and to create things that actually turned out to be quite a detriment. You know, the idea, if you really want to fight a war on poverty, well, then you help lift people out of poverty. You don't build a giant warehouse and warehouse them, which is what they did in the Cabrini projects and others. Some of these well-intended projects had unintended consequences, such as creating the projects. What people think of today is the projects. And just over a 40-year period, the definition and the meaning of that term have just taken on a whole new connotation. So back when this was proposed, the projects were a great thing. And that little town I mentioned next to mine in New Jersey, Patterson, they actually started tearing down some of these buildings. Why? Because they fostered crime. They, you know, they set up these sorts of fiefdoms that just shouldn't exist. Like, well, anyway.
So as we kind of wrap up here, let's talk a little bit about 2018. I'm curious what you think about, you and I go back and where we remember Eisenhower and Kennedy and that whole thing. Do you think this Donald Trump phenomena is just a fad that's just going to bloop, bloop, come and go? Or do you think that this, he's going to open up some worms, some that's never going to go, or some toothpaste that are never going to go back in the toothpaste, you know, tube, and really we'll see some kind of different model for this country.
Until they get him under control. I mean, remember, he only has 7 more years, right? I mean, there's just...
It's a lot of time.
Well, not really.
Not really when they...
Not in their scope of things. They can actually sit back and wait till he's done.
Just pound him for 7 years.
And make sure it never happens again. So,
well, that's really
that's what I think.
Key,
yeah,
it?
That's
yeah.
what... You know, so what happened...
So the boys really blew this one.
Oh, they did in the worst possible way.
They never thought he would...
Never. Well, so, I leave that to the evidence.
So wouldn't you think that they would have enough technology...
Now they will.
...to know that he was going to win and not and really... And miss it by that big of a...
They didn't miss it by much, right?
But I mean but they really... Didn't they all think
the idea that
Hillary was going to win?
Hillary was going to win.
Right.
And she was going to win.
Right. She was going to win.
She didn't have to win big.
But she was going
to win. Yeah.
So they really blew that.
They did. And the momentum that, you know, once it starts, it's hard to stop.
Yeah.
And I've said the difference this time in all previous elections, going back maybe to 1913 and maybe even before that, but at least in the 20th century, and what we call now the 21st, they've controlled both candidates. By the time we got to the general election, both candidates were controlled. So the hysteria, the fervent nature, I mean, you haven't seen that since Andrew Jackson, because they lost control and then had to overwhelm their opposition in doing so, overplayed their hand and revealed themselves. That's what they did this time.
Yeah.
They reinforced what he was suggesting. I mean, think about prior to this election, did anyone talk about the fake news?
No.
It was like, what? What are you talking about? The media? I touched on it briefly in the 20th century, goodness, of the idea that we were taught the Russians had TASS. But TASS is a propaganda. Agency that just gives out propaganda. They don't tell truth. And in the United States here, we have free speech.
Hmm.
What were the Russians taught? Well, the American media just gives propaganda. And here in Russia, we have truth with TASS.
Yeah.
So they do bandy their own agenda. But in this case, they thought for sure that they had the Republican nomination locked up. It was going to be another in the Bush dynasty, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
So they got the Democrats' side under control. I mean, they're much better at it than we were. I mean, the Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the stomping of Bernie Sanders, who rightfully should have won the nomination. I think if you would have left it to the Democratic rank and file, Bernie would have been the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Or certainly the guy before. What was his name? Martin Malone? Nobody even remembers, right? Because they did such a good job of shutting out all the competition. If you've ever seen a NASCAR race and you understand how the independent racer sometimes is faced with a team of 20 racers or 10 or 6, and they all operate together without interest in their individual success because they just their whole interest is making sure one of their teammates wins and that that guy loses. That's what the Republican primary looked like. You had a bunch of guys on one team and one guy on the other team. And it was always from the beginning.
And they didn't care who won.
And they didn't. It started out, oh, Trump's going to gain some traction. Oh, well, then let's throw another guy in the field. Let's throw another guy. Pretty soon you got 27 guys. Somebody's going to like this guy better. No. Everybody wants that guy still. So this time they learned a lot of lessons that they'll never allow to happen again.
Not going
to
happen.
A populist president with enough money to at least get himself through the primaries and then start it. That will never happen again.
They're never going to let that happen ever again. Well, that doesn't bode well for us as Americans, does it?
Yeah. No, it doesn't.
20 years from now?
Does not. Or our kids or our grandkids.
Huh.
You know, the idea that anyone can rise up and become president, you could just throw that fallacy in the garbage after this.
So these people have such a track record, so much money,
yes,
so much control, so much intertanglement of running,
yes,
everything. The,
yes,
boys, we call them.
Yes.
They're not going to screw up again.
No, I believe there was a total coup d'etat in 1963 in the United States.
With Kennedy.
And from that day to this day,
mm,
they've been firmly in control.
Ooh.
No matter which side won, they won. This is the first time in that much history that we had somebody come up out of nowhere. And even still, I'm not convinced that he came out of nowhere. You know, at the end of the day,
yeah,
the cynical side of me says, wait a minute.
Yeah,
maybe they got him too.
Yeah,
I don't know. But I know once he's in, it's not like they're going, oh, well, Donald Trump won. We're going to stop our efforts to bring him over to our way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I believe now they will redouble their efforts in every avenue to bring him in line. And it appears to me that,
well, the president's certainly a hawk. So the military industrial boys, they're,
yeah,
kind of happy, right?
Yeah,
they're kind of happy with him because,
right,
he wants to spend a lot more money on the military.
Yeah.
And he's always talking about ISIS. And,
oh, yeah.
You know,
he gave the soldiers a 2% pay increase.
Did he really?
Two. Not like a fraction of two, but 2% military guy.
Was it you or was it President Trump that said McCain should have been called out because he was ahead of the thing when the...
That was me.
Was it you?
Yeah, he was the chairman
of
the Armed Services.
Tell folks what you said. You know, you told me this the other night. Oh, the other night you,
right,
told me. And I thought about it and I go, OMG.
Yeah. John McCain,
yeah,
the veteran,
yeah,
who knows the suffering of America's troops.
I mean,
well, theoretically.
That's,
I mean,
what
his
he
father
says.
Was an admiral after all.
Yeah, after all.
So, okay, his father was an admiral. And yeah, maybe he got some preferential treatment in the military. Maybe he didn't really know the plight of the average enlisted sailor or soldier. But he was a veteran. And a veteran in wartime, and the chairman of the Armed Services Committee.
During the time when
it
took
VA,
5 months,
right,
to get an appointment.
At the VA. And he did not lift a finger,
wow,
as chairman
a lot about that
of
guy.
The Armed, yeah, Services Committee to help the veterans, which every veteran thought he would. I mean, every veteran thought, oh, John McCain's going to get in there. Boy, we're going to really be set now. No. In fact, I think he did everything he could to protect those inside the VA that were guilty. And who was the first person that said something about it?
Donald Trump.
And wow, you know, it'd be like, oh, you've been in charge of this thing this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
This is under your watch that this happened. And shouldn't you be held responsible for that? Shouldn't you take responsibility for that? Yeah, I applaud the man in his military service, but I do not applaud the man in his senatorial service. I believe as a senator, he did more to go along and get along than any other military man before him.
Well, Andrew Goss, just with President Trump being the president in 2018, it's going to be fun.
Yes.
Because...
exciting.
I mean, he...
never know what he's going to
tweet. Every chance he gets, he pokes these guys right back in,
yes,
the eye.
Yes, he does.
Every chance he,
yeah,
gets.
You hit him, he hits
did
back.
Did you see 300 million? He just said, you guys don't like what I wanted to do in the,
yeah,
Jerusalem thing?
Yeah, just cut your budget.
Just cut your budget.
Yeah.
And the UN, they are part of the boys.
Oh, goodness.
They were
established by the boys.
They are the boys.
World, yeah, government.
Yeah, they, yeah, are the boys.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Because the UN is part of the people that go in with the IMF when the United States liberates a country and make some change their currency.
Yeah.
That's what the UN
does.
It's
curious. You would think that the UN would be welcome, right? That the countries around the world would go, oh, the UN is such a great thing.
No.
But no, they're, the people are suspicious of them, right? The blue hats. The peacekeeping troops.
Amazing.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Yeah, they go in there, and like in Iraq and Kuwait, everywhere, and they'll just make up their currency 0.00008 cents, right?
Right.
You
know? Throw it right out.
Where'd they get that?
Put in their new currency.
So when President Trump says, you know what, we're cutting $300 million from the U.N., again, he takes the giant and says, here, where's your eye?
Let me poke you in both eyes. And curiously,
I love this guy.
If you study the U.N., which people should, you know, the
it's
UN,
a curious organization.
It is indeed. The property that the UN sits on was donated by the Rockefeller family.
I'm shocked.
Yes.
I'm shocked. So who are the other big guys that the boys are really running? It would be the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, BIS, right? All the central banks.
Yeah.
And then the big corps, and they play golf with.
Yeah, you
right?
got it.
And
yeah,
that's just it. These are the globalists.
Yeah, the globalists.
These are the boys.
Of which John McCain is probably a ranking member. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's anything he is. Yeah. And, you know, for him to criticize our president for being a nationalist, that's like criticizing the Pope for being Catholic. You know, it's, oh, he's so Catholic. How can he be Catholic, Catholic?
You're just so
you really
Catholic.
Need to tone down some of that Catholicism. Well, he's the Pope, for goodness sake. If the President of the United States isn't a nationalist, then who is expected to be? I mean, he's the granddaddy of all America, right? He's supposed to be the patriarch, in effect. He's the one that is supposed to be more American than everybody else. We don't want an American president that's a globalist. Of course we want a populist president.
And I loved it, that one speech where he was telling all the different countries, well, you guys should be nationalists, too. If you're from Mexico,
absolutely.
Take care of Mexico.
Yeah, and especially if you're the Mexican president, you should be the most. And if you recall, when the Philippine president, President Obama, forgive me, President Obama, President Obama says to the Philippine president, oh, you're being so harsh on these drug people.
Yeah.
You really need to tone it down a little bit. You know, so you're being so harsh on drug dealers and drug users in your country. And the Philippine president said, well, you don't know anything about what we're going through here with this drug scourge. And Mr. President, go to hell.
I think those
were his exact terms. Or go to hell. Don't tell me what I have to deal with and how I should be easier on my kids. You worry about raising your kids. Hey, how many parents have thought that way?
Yeah,
you know, you've been criticized by other parents for the way you raise your kids. And you're like, no, my kids, I'll raise them the way I want. You raise your kids the way you want. That's the way it should be. So, yes, every president, every leader of every country should be the most jealous advocate for that country that there is. We don't need a president of the United States that's going to go around apologizing for our behavior. Oh, we're so sorry that America is as bad and evil as it is, and please forgive us. Give me a break, would you? If you're going to be the president of the United States, you be a nationalist. You be for your country. If you're going to be the president of Mexico, I wouldn't expect you to do anything that's in the best interest of the United States. I would expect you to do everything that's in the best interest of Mexico, and your people probably will too.
You know, I just had a thought here. With all this consolidation and what's the AT&T? What is the big deal that they may not approve? What was it, AT&T and who?
I give up.
I don't know the latest one. But maybe the FCC could go the other way and start to dismantle some of this thing, and the media could have a lot more.
Trust busting.
Yeah.
Disney bought Fox.
I know.
And nobody's going to raise an eyebrow. Disney, the most liberal network, bought Fox, the most conservative network.
Yeah.
I wonder who's going to change who there.
Yeah.
I wonder if Fox is going to now look like
So
Disney.
Rupert is out? He's not involved anymore? He just sold him. Right?
Sold it.
Wow.
Sold it to Disney.
Well, Bill O'Reilly got out at a good time.
Yeah, I suppose he did.
It's like they're going to do cartoons. Man.
Maybe he'll start a new network. Who knows?
Yeah.
The Salem witch trials have nothing on the madness that's going on now. The presumption of innocence is gone in this country.
It really is.
It's gone.
It's gone.
I get it. Someone's convicted of something and then you throw them out. Well, then that makes sense.
Well, Andrew Goss, God love you. It's great having you as my friend. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So much fun.
It's been an honor to work with you these years, Patrick. I look
forward to it. Been 10 years, right?
Yeah.
10 years. Man, 10 years did this. Andrew Goss buys and sells gold coins for a living. We didn't talk about many products or his company, but you guys have SDL in Hawthorne, New Jersey, and in Hilton Head, right?
Yep.
People want to buy some stuff next year, this year?
Oh, they should.
You're the guy.
And we'll definitely
you demand.
We love your business.
You demand.
Yep. And we do everything we can to educate you and at least make sure that you understand why you should own coins. And if it doesn't make sense to you, well, you know, God bless. Other than that, we strive to provide the best value and the best coins, which is, you know, not just going to sell you a coin because that's what we happen to have, but rather because we think it's the best buy. So.
Well, and I think too that people, when they really understand more what we talk about, it's just like buying real sulfur or real this.
Real anything.
Real anything. Just buy real stuff.
Real rarity in our field. So we examine all of the different coins that are available. And again, we don't just sell you what's available. Many times I've, on this show, talked about a specific coin or a specific type of coin. The most marked one was the first baby born in America? Virginia Dare Roanoke half dollar. All year I've had four coins, all year, four coins. But yet when I talked about it, way more than four people said to me, "Hey, Andy, that's pretty cool. I'd like to have one of those Virginia Dare coins." And many times I'll recommend something that I cannot get, but it's still the best thing for you, whether I have one to sell you or not. And marketing 101 people will tell me, "Oh, that's a big mistake, Andy. You should recommend what you can get in quantity," but that's not what individuals should buy. They should buy things that no one else can buy.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's what really does the trick. So if you have a Virginia Dare Roanoke half dollar from 1937,
I got one in my chest
and you want to sell it to me, well, I'm surely going to buy it because I need way more than I can get my hands on, and it's a good thing for my customers, but unfortunately, I can't really supply the demand. So that's the ones you want to buy. And it's better to be patient and wait and keep your powder dry, as I like to say. Andy, I have money to invest right now. Great. Hold on to it. As soon as I have something worth buying, I'll be sure to give you a call.
Well, with your knowledge of the history and love of this country and the money system, this is what a great synergy for you to have this business, right?
And oh,
your family,
sure.
And you're, you know, having it so long. It's
cool.
I mean, you could out there be selling used cars.
I know. And some of my people, they understand what I just said,
uh-huh.
right? And so they sometimes come off as a little, what shall we say, high pressure. But I'll say this, that you can say this to any one of my employees. No, I'm not interested. Don't call me again, or anything along those lines, and they will honor your request. You will not be badgered. But the enthusiasm that maybe one of my brokers might get when they see into the inventory, oh, wait, it's a Roanoke. It's just been entered today, and no broker has any preference over any other. They're all shown the inventory at the same time. There's one coin available. They might call you with the type of enthusiasm that you would mistake for high pressure. Don't. They're simply expressing the enthusiasm that they've gotten from 10 or 20 years of doing this, that if this Roanoke, once it's gone, there isn't another one for months. And if you miss it, you've missed it. So sometimes in their zeal, if you've been the victim of their zeal, I make myself widely available to anyone who wants to complain. I'm easy to find, and I know that they're not that sort of a broker. They will be that enthusiastic cheerleader for this rare coin, but they're not going to put the high-pressure tactic on you that if you don't buy it, you're going to be financially ruined. You should sell everything you own and buy gold coins because the world's going to end next week. That's not what you're going to get here.
Right.
But the enthusiasm for the individual rare coins is unmistakable in my operation.
Well, I've met a lot of the people there. Good folks. You
they're
know.
All good folks.
Fun,
yeah.
fun folks.
I love
fun
them.
Folks.
Yeah.
All right, brother. Well, I will see you, I guess, we're going to see you here on One Radio Network next Wednesday.
Well,
as we kick off 18. Yep. Andrew's number in both places now is 800-468-2646, 800-468-2646. Thanks again for coming.
Thank you. Yeah, we're Consolidated Switchboard now. So, yes, there's one number to call.
One number to call, and you're rocking.
Find us wherever we are. And, yes, I wish you a happy and a healthy new year.
Happy new year to you.
A prosperous new year to all of our listeners. I hope everything works out exactly the way you need it.
There you go. Okay, Andrew, thanks a lot. We love you. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. We'll see you tomorrow with Richard Massey.
Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.